Okay, so the original chair is not here, so I'll be filling in and chairing this session. And our first speaker is Rose Luckin. We'll speak about Who Moved My Intelligence.
Thank you. I'll just move around because I always wander around when I'm talking, so I'm better off at the front than trying to sit down. Now, just check.
It is. Good. Excellent. So I always think it's a good idea to give people a heads up about what I'm going to say in a talk within the title. So basically, I am going to talk about who moved my intelligence and how education can use artificial intelligence to boost human intelligence. So it is about implications of artificial intelligence for education and the skills workplace, but very much in terms of how also we use AI. So just to start off, and I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes is what I've been asked to do. So I'm obviously happy to take questions in the question part of the agenda. So I was very lucky last year to spend some time in Australia. Very nice, nice climate. My daughter lives there. And while I was working at University of Sydney, I watched a program on the television called The AI Race. I had quite a lot of academics, mainly Australian academics, in this television program, all talking about the implications of artificial intelligence for the skills agenda. And I thought this was a particularly interesting piece of analysis that was done by one of the companies that they worked with called Alpha Beta. You know, and yeah, automation is changing the way we work. I love this notion that we're going to have 2 hours, machines will unburden the average Australian of 2 hours of the most tedious and manual work a week over the next 15 years. Hey, wouldn't that be great? 2 hours gained every week. I'm not sure that I quite agree with this, but I thought it was quite nice to see it being sold in this way rather than AI is going to come and take your job, beware. So it was more of a positive, upbeat session. But the program itself was very interesting. I've worked in the area for quite a while. I actually remember Kevin coming to University of Sussex when I was studying there to give a presentation there. Very good it was too. I've studied artificial intelligence. I've built systems that use artificial intelligence. But most of the time these days, I'm really concerned for half of my time looking at the implications of artificial intelligence on education, you know, as well as how we build systems that can help deliver some educational aims or benefits. So I was very struck by some of the things that were being said by some of the students and the sort of general members of the public about artificial intelligence during this program called the AI Race. You know, schools should be telling us about this. That was said about the fact that, you know, an AI paralegal could go away and search millions of documents and come up with a precise clause in minutes in comparison to the time it would take, you know, a human to do it and things like this. So 60% of students are studying for jobs that will not exist in 30 years' time. You know, this is quite a hard thing for the education systems across multiple countries to be thinking about. You know, how are we going to tackle this? And how do we use AI to help us tackle this is what I would also say. And lots of conversations, you know, the cliche, data is the new oil. Okay, fine. Key skills will be able to work with an AI, emotional intelligence, conversation, social interaction, you know, need to change the curriculum. But in the end, it's our choice as humans to decide how we're going to allow these technologies to impact on the workplace, to impact on education and training, as well as how we decide how we're going to use them. But how do we get hold of that? You know, what are the key issues and how do we as people such as myself working in the education space, how do we encourage politicians to think about policy implications? How do we engage the general public with thinking about these issues? And how do we actually build the kinds of AI technologies that will help people to benefit from the potential that AI could bring rather than it just being seen as it's a problem when we've got to do something about it. We've got to teach differently. We've got to teach different things. So, you know, it's a bit of a dilemma. We don't actually know what the jobs will be. There's lots of analysis done across multiple countries using different methodologies about what jobs are and are not most likely to be automated or augmented with AI. And there's no clear consensus of opinion about whether it'll be this percentage of jobs that'll change or whether actually there'll be lots of new jobs. There's lots of different views depending on who's coming from where. So it's actually quite difficult as an educator when you don't actually know what the goalpost might be that you're aiming for. Obviously, things like numeracy and literacy are fundamental, but where else should prioritization be focused? So there's no consensus of opinion about exactly what impact AI will have. So that's hard for educators and trainers to work out what they do to prepare employees of the future. And, you know, how do we identify the skills and the knowledge that people should have, and then also alongside it, because all education systems require some kind of assessment, how do we assess them? So there's some of the key questions, and as I was trying to work out a way of engaging people in discussing these, I looked back and thought, oh, I need a self-help book. I need to write a self-help book to help people help themselves to work more effectively with AI, or to work out what the implications of AI are for them. So I looked around at the literature and found this lovely little book called Who Moved My Cheese? It may be familiar to some of you. Basically, it's a lovely story about some mice and some men who search around a maze for cheese, find cheese, and then the cheese disappears. And the most stubborn of the men goes, "Who's moved my cheese? You know, everything's unfair." It's all about life changing. Cheese is happiness, but life changes, and somebody moves your happiness and your satisfaction. And the mice go off and they find more cheese, but the stubborn humans don't move because somebody's taken their cheese and it's not fair. Until one of them starts to think more differently and think, well, actually, maybe I should go off and see if there is some more cheese here. So he goes off, finds more cheese, never managed to persuade his colleague that he should also think about moving and thinking of new ways of working. So he ends up writing some messages on the walls of the maze so that if his reticent colleague does at some point decide they would like to go off in search of, you know, some cheese, there's some helpful messages there to guide them along their way. And I'll come to those messages right at the end. But it got me thinking, this notion of who moved my cheese, this kind of feeling about intelligence is moving, if you like, to artificial systems, and what are the implications of that, and some of our jobs and our roles and our skills are moving from humans to machines, and how do we deal with that? So I thought about this Who Moved My Cheese and thought, well, you know, there's multiple interpretations, and I'm going to talk about two. Actually, I'm going to talk about one. I'm going to highlight two interpretations and then talk about one. So we could think of moving intelligence exactly as I've just outlined it. It's a case of moving certain intelligent work from humans to machines. That seems to be, you know, quite a legitimate way of looking at the situation. Not necessarily whole jobs, but parts of jobs. So things like the paralegal work that I talked about earlier, that moving from humans to machines. So we could think about intelligence moving in that way. Although I hope we won't look at it as this little man is here waving off the intelligence, because what we actually need to do is to think, okay, now how do we benefit from that? We don't have to do this thing anymore. So how can we enrich our intelligence and do something more worthwhile, you know, more complex? What is it? So there's that way of looking at it as well. And that kind of takes me to the second interpretation, which is the one I really want to focus on. So we could think about, from my perspective as an educator or as a trainer in a company, of moving our students' intelligence beyond what is often seen as being of value, the kind of routine processing that is much of what happens within the academic curriculums of most education systems, and what is often part of training that happens in the workplace. Not training for skills like flipping burgers or whatever, but in terms of a lot of training, it's still very much based on a curriculum and somebody helps you to understand that or delivers that curriculum. So maybe we need to think about how we can use AI to help us achieve some of that more effectively, but not just think about AI as helping us to build systems that can do that academic knowledge building with students, but also maybe to think about how we can use AI to make us smarter. Because I always like to say, this is to talk really about intelligence, and it's actually intelligence is the thing that we need to bear in mind, because it's our human intelligence that's going to make sure that we can always outsmart the robots. And that's something that we need to bear in mind, but we need to think about what that intelligence is. And I think currently we probably undervalue human intelligence in terms of seeing it very much in its narrowest sense within most education and training systems, because we're actually, in the main, helping students to engage with material that a large percentage of which could be learnt faster by an AI if we happen to have an AI to learn that particular part of the academic curriculum. And that's not necessarily a particularly intelligent thing to do in an education system. So, as an example, it's a very basic example. I could say to you, where have you been this morning? And you'll all know. I can say to you, what do you know about AI? And some of you know masses and masses and masses about AI more than I do, and some of you maybe don't. And I can say, how well do you understand calculus? And even if you don't understand calculus, you all know you don't understand calculus. And if you do know calculus, you're probably, you know, well, actually, I'm fairly good at calculus. Although the evidence would suggest that we tend to overestimate our knowledge about something rather than underestimate it in many cases. And how are you feeling right now? I guess you could all answer that. They're very human ways of processing information. This meta-awareness is very much something that we can be good at as humans. We're not always good at as humans, but it's actually something that, of course, machine learning types of AI struggle with enormously. And being able to explain what it is you know and why you've made a decision, of course, is a fundamental problem, but it's something humans are good at. So perhaps we might think that focusing on that part of intelligence, as well as many other parts, I'm not saying only that part, but actually that could be a good way of thinking about how we work with AI. And this is where I think there's a really lovely finesse, because actually it's AI that can help us to become better at that. So what I'm saying is we can use artificial intelligence to help us be more intelligent. We can help use artificial intelligence to help us understand ourselves more effectively, to understand what we do know, what we don't know, how best we learn, where we have challenges, how we might get help with those challenges, so that we as humans become more self-effective, would be what I would say. Because to be self-effective as a learner, which of course is one thing we know we're going to have to do in the workplace, we might not know what we're going to have to learn, but we sure as heck know people are going to have to learn for much more of their lives, so let's make sure people are good at learning. And in order to be good at learning and to be self-effective, you need to have a pretty good understanding of what you do know, what you don't know, and how you go about learning. So that's what we could do in the education system. And we could use AI to help us. So this is actually quite an old piece of software. This is a piece of software I wrote several years ago, and I use it as an example because it's, you know, it's a little AI system that helps primary school age children develop better awareness of their own abilities when it comes to learning about food chains and food webs. It's there to support or to scaffold their metacognitive awareness of how much they understand by helping them make more accurate predictions of the difficulty of a task that they might be able to take on and the amount of help that would be just about enough to get them to be successful, but not too much. So the whole idea is the system builds a model of this, the individual child's metacognitive awareness of their understanding of food chains and webs and their ability to seek the appropriate help, and then supports and scaffolds them not just to be better at learning food webs, but to be better at understanding their own ability to learn food chains and food webs. And we know we can do that. And interestingly enough, the empirical evaluation of that system showed very nicely that actually students who'd been rated as being less able by their teachers and less able by the standardized assessment metrics did better in terms of making vast amounts of progress when it came to building metacognitive awareness. That's not to say that more able students can't do it too. It's just nice to see that actually the biggest progress was made by the less able students. So humans are capable of metacognition and self-knowledge. AI can't really understand itself yet, but AI can help us to understand ourselves better. So that's the nice little finesse. And it's not just in terms of standard bits of the curriculum, like learning about food chains and food webs. We can also do it with collaborative problem solving, for example. Recent PISA evaluation of collaborative problem solving demonstrated that even the country that scored the best, Singapore, and also scored the best in many, if not all, of the rest of PISA's evaluations, even that country, students could not, only 21% of the population that took the collaborative problem-solving test run by PISA in Singapore could do the higher levels of collaborative problem-solving. And yet collaborative problem-solving is something we need a lot in the workplace. So this is going to be a whiz through a very quick example to show how we can help to open the black box, if you like, using AI to help students and teachers understand when elements of collaborative problem solving are happening effectively. So we ran some studies with some students. They were set a little task to make an interactive toy. We collected a lot of data about them. We collected, you can see the markers on their hands. We did a lot of hand movement tracking. We did eye tracking. We collected data about what they built. They could hit a button to say, I'm feeling good or I'm feeling lousy. Multiple data channels. We also had human observers because we wanted to understand if we were to build some analytics, some data science analytics, what data could we use and how could we analyze it in order to say, this student's not collaborating so well, or this student is, or this group's working effectively, to help a teacher know when they needed to offer some assistance. So with all of these data sources, as I say, fiducial markers, the actual software they were using to build the technology, they had a mobile system where they could enter what they were doing. As I say, they had the yay, I've got it, and the ah, that's hard buttons. And of course we got a nice little chart like this, that's time going across the bottom there. And you can see, but what does it actually tell you? Well, it tells you their eyes were here, their eyes were there, they hit the button here, they hit the button there. But actually it's not ultra helpful. And if you're a teacher, it's actually not very helpful at all. So if we then layer on top of that, something that we've developed that kind of breaks down the competencies of collaborative problem solving, this is very much in line with the evidence, including that used by the PISA evaluators. And we get a human to use something like this to grade a video of the students. Then we can start looking at how we map the human evaluation of what's effective in terms of these components of collaborative problem solving with that data that we're gathering automatically. And just to give you a very quick example, if we look at something like synchrony, there's already existing evidence to show that synchrony of eye direction. So are they all looking at the project? Are they looking away? Are they looking at each other? If there's synchrony within the group, then that is linked with positive learning outcomes. So there's a body of evidence there that's done some work suggesting that. So we thought, well, let's look for synchrony. Let's look and see if synchrony of eye gaze is in any way linked to the human evaluation of the groups that are more effective. You can't obviously read this whole thing, but basically the dark lines are the groups who are judged more effectively by the human evaluator. And hey, guess what? They're also the ones where the eye gaze was more synchronous. So if they were all looking at the artifact they were building or all looking at each other, then that was linked to more effective collaborative problem solving. So all I'm doing is saying, look, here's an example of ways in which we could use AI to analyze data that we can collect automatically that can tell us something useful about the learning process, something we wouldn't have been able to gather on our own. Because if I'm a teacher and I've got a class of 30 and they're all working in groups of four, I can't possibly know what they're all doing, but this can give us some insight. So it's about AI being used to make us smarter. Because if data's the new oil, then we need to use AI to process it, because it's crude, just like oil that comes out of the ground. So we can use AI to refine that crude data to help us understand more about ourselves. And that's something that we will need to do, whatever the way that the jobs change in the future. And indeed, whatever the ways that AI impacts on people's lives. So going back to my mice and my men, these are the messages that the man, who decided he would go and look for cheese, wrote for his collaborator who didn't want to go. So this was the version in Who Moved My Cheese, and my suggestion is this is what we now need to look at. And it's all about intelligence. It's all about, you know, intelligence is something we want to seek. So computers are getting smarter, intelligent tasks are moving from humans to machine. It's going to keep happening. It's not going to stop. So we need to understand what that means. We need to understand enough about AI to know what that means. We need to prepare for some of our intellectual activity to be taken on by AI. I mean, I think everybody in this room kind of understands that, but for a lot of the population, that's a really hard thing to contemplate. We need to keep checking in on our own intelligence to make sure we're really using it and keeping it fresh. So it's not a case of, oh, well, I've just got my degree. That's fine. I'll go off into the workplace and, you know, that's fine. I'm set for life. No, it's not going to be like that anymore. We need to keep checking whether we're keeping up to date. We need to adapt to change thoughtfully. Quickly was used in the original then that's obviously not appropriate here. So we need to think about it thoughtfully. We need to offload the right intellectual activity to the AI and keep the intellectual activity that's really better done by humans with the humans. So we need to move with the intelligence. That's the message. And we need to enjoy intelligence because the experience of developing greater intelligence is good. It tastes good. It's nice to be smart. That's the key message. Being smart's a nice thing to do. And we need to never feel that we're intelligent enough so that we keep striving for intellectual growth. Just the way that people wear their Apple Watch or their Fitbit to track their health, we need to be thinking of the Fitbit for the mind, for the intellect, so that we keep on growing our human intelligence, taking advantage of AI to help us to do that. So intelligence is the real power. That's what we've got to focus on as humans, as well as building machines that behave intelligently. And that's where I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And the next talk is by Ben Louveni. I don't know what the title is, but it'll come up soon.
It worked? Yeah, great. So, it's not working, this one? Perfect. So, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. My name is Ben. I'm the CEO and founder of Verkey. Today, in less than 20 minutes, I think I have less than 20 minutes, I will try to show you how we are doing, how we are using AI actually to improve certain things under HR. But just before of that, a little thing about myself. I'm an engineer. I was in the intelligence, in the Israeli in intelligence forces. And actually, when someone asked me why I opened a company in the HR space, so I always laugh and I'm telling them, I don't know, but the actual reason that I don't know nothing about HR, I know a lot about algorithms, so that's the reason why I'm actually did that. So long story short, after the army, I joined a startup in the storage space. We got acquired by IBM. So I found myself working for a big corporate in America for almost 6 years. And I found my partner over there, Amichai. He is actually the smart one between us. He worked for Mobileye before that. Then he worked in XAV. So he's the one who is doing the algorithms in the company. So a quick overview of where we currently are. We started more than 2 years ago. We are more than 35 employees. Most of us are actually engineers, and we raise in public around $8 million. And there's a new round that will be published soon. I hope. Before we actually tell you what we are actually doing, I want to start by telling you that I'm sorry, and not only on my behalf. I'm sorry for my whole generation, the millennials, the me. Generation. You probably know them. First of all, we think that we are smarter than anyone. So everything I'm telling you today is probably true. The second thing, we want to switch job every 2 years. And we want to get visibility on our career. We want so many things. But our main problem that we are not requesting our employers for anything. We are demanding. We are demanding for things like cereals in the morning, dog walker for our puppies, pools during lunch, interesting office. By the way, chef becomes standard on every tech company. I even saw some company that lets every one of their employees to decorate their own office. But actually, to be honest, that's not the biggest. We have a much more bigger problem than that now. No kidding, not that. Your kids, the next generation, Generation Z. The problem, they born with an iPad. They go with everywhere. They brush their teeth with an iPad. They watch TV. They are like, that's my nephew, by the way. Like every day they are using their iPad. So the next generation is something companies really need to get ready for. And actually what we are trying to do is to help companies to adapt into those cultural changes. So if we take a look a little bit on the technology, we see there's a lot of things that are happening in the past that now that is available. One of them, the data, we have a lot of public data information that we can use in order to be smarter and in order to get our algorithms to be able to predict and be smarter and to get smarter from day to day. So I want to jump and like to tell you about the company missions. How we actually started. We started by creating a smart algorithm that takes your career history and compare that to millions of others. And using statistics, we were able to predict what your next step can look like. So that was a very big mission. I will, in the next two slides, I will jump to the actual thing that we are doing. And just before that, I want to focus on the problems that we are facing. So it took me 2 years to understand, but now I know that for sure. HR is a very tough space, but a lot of things is under HR. Payroll, compensation, there's a lot of things. But what we are trying to focus on are actually two main things. One of them is recruitment. Most of our talents today are passive seekers, and we want to help companies to adapt and to get those passive seekers. And the second thing is retention. You know, companies are fighting so much on getting those talents, but once they are in the company, if they don't help them to understand how they can advance their career inside the company, they will just leave. So those two problems is the thing that we are trying to solve here at the company. So let's jump to our solution. The players in the game, and sorry for I'm trying to be very practical now. I will actually show you a live demo if it would be possible. So the players in the game is on the right, we have the companies and hiring managers. And on the left, we have candidates. So we are starting by collecting so many data from public sources. And using machine learning algorithms, we are able to predict for every one of the candidates that signs up through our platform, how his career path can look like. By the way, we just chosen last month by CB Insights to be the most innovative company that is doing AI in the HR space. So it is very good news for us. And based on that, we are offering two main products. One of them is the Rocky Path. That's the external marketplace. That's a way we are helping every one of the candidates that signs up to see how his career path can look like. I want to stop for a second and actually to show you how it looks from the company side. Maybe it will be interesting for you to get the actually bits and bytes. So for the demonstration, imagine that you are let's take a company you probably know, Mobileye. That you're the hiring manager of a company named Mobileye. By the way, that's a live demo, so if you know, for my Israeli colleagues, if you know someone from this, so forget about them. So imagine that you are the hiring manager in a company named Mobileye, and I want to show you our product. So the first thing I'm telling you is to pick a position on your left. And after you picked a position, by the way, how we started back then, we created some smart crawlers that takes all the career pages websites, and using NLP, we'll be able to take all the unstructured data and put it over here. And actually, that's not the reason we got funded, but it helped us a lot during the sales process. So again, that's a live demo, so let's see if it will work. If not, we will just move on. Let's take a look again. Maybe I have an open one. Oh, okay. So after you picked a position on your left, you see that every boxer is a relevant candidate that might be a good fit for that specific position. And the idea that we put in this market, that using our algorithms, we will be able to highlight only the important things that the hiring managers need to decide between 5 to 10 seconds if they like the candidate or not. And the second thing that you probably notice, there's no contact details over here. And I remember when I did a sales pitch for the first customers, I told them that. So they were laughing and they told me, yeah, because they want to take money from me. So I told them, I laughed. I said, I want to take money from you. But the actual reason is not you. I want to make a safe place for those passive seekers. And I want to be a very non-biased platform that even using AI and machine learning, you won't be able to realize and to see who is behind that box. And the idea for me is simple. If you like the candidate, you're doing thumbs up. If you don't like him, you're doing thumbs down. And that actually how our system learns from the activity, from the feedbacks we get from the HR and from the candidate side. And again, if I will have, I want to show you how it looks like from the background. Actually, that's not something that I'm not used to show for people that outside the company, but I want to show you a glimpse of how it looks like from the data science team and how they investigate every appearance of a box. Let's see if we can see that. Okay, so that's how we actually calculate every one of those boxes that you saw in the previous page. But I want to pick a specific person just to show you how we calculate every score. So if you remember my first note, actually I don't know nothing about HR, but I know a bit about algorithms. So what we did, we took this unstructured world and we created a lot of features out of that, and we let our HR and our candidates to solve us a very sophisticated problem, because they are every day doing thumbs up and thumbs down for us, and they actually help us to weight every one of those features for us to understand if we are doing if we are in the right way or we are not in the right way. So sorry for I'm being a little bit too technical. So let's go back to the presentation. There's a quick video that summarizes that. Let's see.
Meet Steve. Steve, like all of us, is wondering what his next career move should be. Worky helps Steve ensure he finds his true path and utilizes his friend's connections to get him there. Based on Steve's history and social footprint, Worky analyzes his top skills and areas of interest. Worky applies big data analytics to compare Steve's path with millions of others. This allows Worky to predict and suggest the most relevant prospects for Steve, today and in the future. This way, Steve gets recommendations for relevant opportunities and is empowered through the utilization of his social connections, providing Steve with a lead for each and every opportunity. And since Worky partners with the largest corporations and the coolest startups, we were able to confidentially promote Steve to potential employers based on a combination of Worky's analysis and Steve's connections. As for Steve just needs to decide which companies receive his contact details, and that's exactly how Steve will find the next step in his career, guided by the path of Worky.
So that's a bit theoretical, but I want to show you. We just released last month. We released an app that includes a chatbot that tries to analyze you. So that's how it looks from the candidate side. Now this one. We started in Israel, I would say, in the beginning of 2016. Now we have more than 600 customers that are using us on a weekly basis, and we have around 55% of all the tech industry already onboarded into our platform. So we are, I think we are doing a very good job with that. And just one last thing before I finish. There's another product that we are doing. It's more for the enterprise. We realize that we are getting smarter every day, and we are creating career path for people to look outside of their companies. And we realize there's a big opportunity to help people to see how their career can advance internally in the company. So we created a working inner path. That's the internal marketplace where we let enterprises, big companies like IBM, to help their employees build a career path internally. And actually, I'm traveling quite often to London. One of our biggest customers, headquarters is here, and it's a Fortune 500 company. They have more than 200,000 size of employees. And that's a very good thing that we are actually doing, not in public yet. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you both, and we're happy to take questions for both speakers.
Thank you for two very interesting talks. So one problem I can see is that this is all based on getting a lot of data, especially the later talk. And that seems to make sense if you are having fairly normal skills that we're going to be a lot of data points about. Super rare skills and super rare skill combinations are going to be very hard to get statistical significance for. So they're going to be extremely noisy for the algorithms. So how do we get around that? Because it seems like it's the small data rather than big data that typically provides the most value when we can actually make the right decisions there.
The question about data is actually not only skills. There's a lot of things that we are trying to learn. I'll give you an example that what we learned while we did the first research. We saw that people are not so sophisticated. Careers life, people when they look on their own career path, it's actually divided into three parts. I would say 30% of them want to progress in their own profession. They want to be more pro in what you are trying to do. The second one want to get to go higher in the hierarchy. They want to be manager. And the third one, by the way, it was shocking a little bit for me. More than 25%, it depends on the profession, want to shift their career, want to do a completely a career shift. So we are using a lot of big data in order to understand those points. And after we understand them, we are able to take those and to help people with less data and how we can actually advance their career path. So that's what we actually do. And the second part that I wanted to answer, we are not only looking on technical stuff, we are looking even on something that relates to your personality and social, for example. Even if you're using a Gmail account or a Hotmail account, it might be something that indicates something about you. So there's a lot of things that you're trying to look while we gather in information around you.
Yeah. I think it's a really good question. And I think as far as education is concerned, actually, we have to be really careful about getting that right blend of where the human intervention happens in the education and where the machine takes on some of the challenge, because I think there's a risk that if we employ the kinds of techniques that might take a large data set of very fine-grained interaction data from a group of learners, for example, you might end up missing out the Einstein who hasn't yet bloomed, because they're not showing those kind of easily observed and normally recognized types of skills and abilities. And I think it is about getting the balance right. It may be possible to build systems that could, at first glance, provide very useful information about learner progress and make decisions for learners, so taking away the role of the teachers. I think that would be really the wrong way to go, which is why my stress is on let's use the data to help us understand our learners, help the learners understand themselves, help teachers understand themselves and understand how they can be better teachers, because I think, you know, that this is not an exact science, this teaching and learning malarkey. We know quite a lot about how people learn, but we're still learning as well. So, yeah, I think it's a very valid point, and it is that bit about balance, about offloading the right things to the AI.
I'd like to ask you, I got the impression that you are against standard curricular progression and were in favor of learning how to learn. But in my view, part of intelligence is being able to make connections between the things that you know. So you cannot get rid of just learning facts. I mean, that's how algorithms learn as well. They learn from data and they learn how to make connections between them. So can you clarify what your position is in that sense?
Yes, I will, because again, it's a really good question. So it's sort of some steps in this. So absolutely, that is how we train a lot of algorithms. And certainly, you know, if I look at the literature that's been very influential in the way the UK curriculum is based and the assessment system, it's actually calls on the same psychologists as the early AI systems did. So there's absolutely a connection. But the problem is we've now built systems that can learn more accurately and more quickly, and don't forget, for a large bodies of the sorts of academic knowledge that we do focus on within schools. Not all of it. So we need to think about how we deal with that and how we deal with that intelligently. Now, I think what you've just said about being able to apply what you've understood, bearing in mind that knowledge itself is not something that's given, it's something you construct for yourself. But being able to understand how you apply what you've learned in different sorts of situations is something that can be taught very well through collaborative problem solving. So I'm not saying don't learn the same things. I'm saying perhaps we need to think about learning them differently. Some things we do need to still perhaps stay the same. But what I would say is, what does an intelligence-based curriculum look like as opposed to a knowledge-based curriculum? It's about taking that one step away from the knowledge, so that you don't see it as something you're just given. You see it as something you construct, and you know how to look for evidence, how to make good judgments about what is true, what isn't true. Do you see what I mean? So it's about looking at it differently, not doing away with it altogether.
Hello, Anata Khalal, Digital Catapult. Thank you for two really interesting talks. Question, I guess, mainly for Ben. I really liked the component in which the profiles are anonymized to remove bias. And the question is around past bias. So obviously the training data was obtained in situations where the demographic and other bias-creating data points were there. What do you do to remove this bias from your models?
That's a very good question, actually. It's a tricky one. So what we are actually doing, we are saving 20% of the candidates that we are showing every time. I'm not sure if you noticed, but we are showing only between 10 to 15 candidates every day. So we are saving 20% of those. We are eliminating few of our machine learning weights for the features. So we're like letting only filter-based filters to see if we are mistaken over here. And those 20% sometimes for some companies are very surprising because they are picking only from those 20%. So that's how we are actually trying to do that, to eliminate.
For Ben, obviously there's a lot of similarities between your product and matchmaking products like Tinder or whatever. And one, I think, interesting direction is this idea of honesty. Many of the profiles on matchmaking sites are false. Is that a problem for you? Is the sociology somehow different that people will be more truthful in your site?
So another good question. Actually, a lot of, like, actually more journalists compare us to Tinder. Yeah, I'm not sure if I like the comparison, but they call us the Tinder for jobs. And the opposite from there's a lot of more data points that we are trying to collect. And to be honest, it's very difficult for someone to fake his public profile presence. Like if it's in GitHub, Stack Overflow, LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever, there's so many data points we're trying to cross to see if something someone is saying and is not actually knowing that specific skill. And the second thing, part of our AI and part of our IP is that we build an ontology. So we are trying to even weight everything that they are saying to, they actually know. We are trying to weight that, to see there's enough of other skills that support that. So if you are even trying to say that you know, for example, a coding language, AngularJS, and you don't have enough skills to support that, or school that you studied, or you're even in the right age, sorry for that. It's funny, by the way, I will tell you a story. We saw someone saying that he knows Backbone more than 7 years, and this language only created only, I think, 4 years ago. So there's a lot of interesting things that we are that we are seeing, and our algorithms are learned to analyze that.
Ben, in a way, you may know about people more than they know about themselves, right? So what you're going to do with that is, like, if I want to go to you now and get a view, what will be my next move? Will you tell me?
That's basically what you're trying to do. We're looking on your career history, and we're helping you to see how you're... It's funny, we saw that, like, most of the people don't know actually what they are looking for. Like, I would say only 10 to 15% of the people knows I'm looking for a specific job in a specific company. By the way, if you do know that, LinkedIn is the best place for you. You just go up and you search the company and you find a friend. But most of the people don't really know how the next step can look like. So that's where we come to play. Our idea that we will create you a map, we will create you a career path, that you will see your different style of opportunities, and we'll help you to do that. Actually, not only in the external marketplace, also in the company that you're currently working with. For example, I work for IBM. If someone ever told me that I can switch between roles inside the company, I would probably will stay in that company. But the only way they gave me as an employee to see how I can evolve my career path, they gave me a big job board with thousands of pages. Nothing really relates to me. I really can't do nothing with that jobs. So using our platform, we are showing every one of the employees all his career paths that he can do inside the company, and we are actually helping them to get it. So we are bridging them with the hiring managers. So to answer your questions, yeah.
Nothing's over to me. So hope you can all hear me. It's almost 3 o'clock, so we'll crack on. So we've covered today so far deep learning. We've covered systems. We've covered digital skills. We've covered education. We've covered Tinder. We've covered moving cheese. So now it's on to the hard edge of AI, which is showcasing industry uses of AI and UK corporate engagement with Israeli startups on this really important issue. And I'm going to acknowledge and introduce my colleague, Donna Harge, who is the head of the London office, the UK office of the UK Israel Tech Hub. She's doing a great job. So I've already agreed with Ben that you are banned from Worky for the next 5 years at least. So Donna, over to you.
Thank you, Tommy. So for those who just joined us for the second part of the day, the UK Israel Tech Hub is a UK government initiative that was launched 60 years ago with a goal to boost economic growth in both countries by building tech collaboration. And the way that we do it is we help UK corporates gain a competitive edge through partnering with Israeli innovation. And that could be in several forms. It could be in a form of helping them scout for Israeli innovation according to their needs. It could be in a form of helping them set up an R&D facility, an accelerator program in Israel, an incubator program in Israel, and so on. And from the other end, we also help Israeli companies and startups and innovators look at the UK as a destination to grow and expand it. And we do that by showcasing the various opportunities and collaboration opportunities that they have in the UK. We receive our brief from the UK mainly, and we're active in sectors where we identified a unique synergy in. So we're active in retail, in insurance, in fintech, in cyber, in AI, of course, and digital health, and so on. And we measure ourselves mainly by commercial partnerships and the strategic benefit that we were able to bring to the UK as a result of partnering with Israel. And we're very happy to say that we were able to sign and help sign 100 commercial deals between a UK corporate and an Israeli startup. And that resulted of a £600 million to the UK economy. We're even more happy to share that the UK government has recognized this as a success, and now we're rolling out globally in 5 additional countries, all based on the Israeli model. We're here today because we believe building AI ties between the UK and Israel is key to create economic prosperity, and we're very happy to showcase some of the case studies of UK corporates working with Israeli startups around AI and more. Thank you.
Donna, thanks. So when I was, I'm a humble UK diplomat who has to skim the surface of many, many different issues on any given day. So when I was asked to chair a discussion about artificial intelligence, I quickly realized that all my intelligence on this issue was entirely artificial. So we've invited a UEFA Champions League quality of a panel of speakers here today. So no pressure, guys, no pressure. One of you might be the Arsenal at the end of the day. It's a great panel. So we have Anthony Balin, who's the head of startup engagement for Aviva. Ofri Ben-Porat, who's the CEO and co-founder of Pixoni. We have Roshan Rohadsky, I'm sure I pronounced that incorrectly. Yeah. Close enough, brilliant. Who's the senior digital innovation lead at the Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS. And then Nick Pregwin, who is the head of Bold 360 AI for NanoRep. So Anthony's going to kick off, I think, with his comments. I think you've got some slides, is that correct?
I thought it was a presentation, so I prepared slides. We can go either way that you want, really.
It's up to you. It's up to you. The key point is you have 10 minutes. The stopwatch is absolutely on you. Now, our relationship with Aviva, the Tech Hub's relationship with Aviva, is going from strength to strength, and it's been a real test case for us, really, as to where we've taken our time to explain the benefits of engaging with Israel to a major UK corporate. Aviva sponsored an event at TechExchange last year. And we've had Aviva senior staff going to Cyber Week in Israel, and there was a scoping visit there only this month from Aviva senior officials. So, Anthony, with your very, very good slide.
Yeah.
And your excellent Christian name, off you go.
Thanks. So, yes, for those who don't know me, I'm Anthony Balin. I'm the Global Head of Innovation for Aviva. Hopefully the British attendees know who we are. The Israelis, probably not, but hopefully I'll fill you in. I actually thought this was going to be a low-key discussion. I see half the table as professor at the beginning of the name. So as I've got the graveyard shift at 3 o'clock, this is kind of AI in insurance for dummies. And it's probably been more useful in explaining to my wife what my job is rather than the group here. But yeah, we'll have a go. So insurance, a very old industry. And Aviva's role within the industry has been particularly well established. This is important because we have over 320 years of data, and a key parameter of how we're going to make artificial intelligence work for the future is going to be based on the data. We date ourselves back to 1717. Sir Isaac Newton was a customer in the first year. And whether it's been the London exhibition in 1862, Sir Walter Scott becoming our chairman in 1824, Winston Churchill taking life insurance from us, or as very smartly being the first underwriters of the Titanic, we've had a lot of data, and we've had a lot of experience and understanding over that last 320 years, the patterns that are emerging when it comes to risk. But it works in a very simple way today. And actually, I say today, and I mean in 2018, you get a form like this, half of which you don't understand, but you fill it in anyway, giving the best assumptions you can possibly find. A smart guy like this will take all of that data, we call him an actuary, and try and analyze what that means to make a very simple decision. Are you a risk we're willing to undertake? Over the last 320 years, have you demonstrated risk profiles or elements of your behavior that correlate with the good and bad risks we've taken on in the past? And that's how it's worked. It's worked successfully. We had a 40 billion revenue last year, and people are happy. This is a picture from 1797 of the Lloyd's underwriting room in the City of London. This is how it's all been done for the last 300 years. Human, not artificial intelligence. And I'm pretty sure this guy here still works for the company somewhere. When people talk to me about AI, it's going to impact insurance, it's going to make a huge difference, I often try and break it down, and I stole this, I think, from KPMG, the insurance value chain, because what makes us different to, I think, some of the startups is we provide the whole chain, the product, the marketing, the underwriting, the claims, and the service. And AI can impact every individual element. So let's talk about product creation. So insurance policies used to be static. You give the data, we give you a risk profile, we translate that to a price, and we hope 93-95% of our customers don't even use the product they've paid for. That's the ambition, right? That's probably the only product I can think of that you don't want to, that we don't want the customers to use and the customer doesn't want to use. So how do we start to use AI to make products more interactive and interesting? So Aviva Drive's an example of ours that I'm going to use. We use the mobile phone, which is full of sensory sensors, and we use the data that creates to understand braking, movement, speed, direction, geolocation. And in real time, we can take that data and we can analyze it to create a dynamic pricing. We turn it into a risk score and present that back to the customer. And by analyzing that risk score in real time, we can almost make per journey, per trip, a priceable element, changing the dynamic from a static annual policy to a real-time dynamic product. This is how AI can fit into product creation. Let's talk about distribution and marketing. Chatbots made a huge break onto the scene last year. They seem to have disappeared quite quickly. But I think the artificial intelligence to help us serve our customers is going to be a key driver in the 21st century. Quote Me Happy, a sub-brand, did a Facebook chatbot earlier in the year. And it gives us some of the key metrics that we need to operate in a digital-first economy. No longer can a broker sell it and we service it. We need to be automated. We need to be 24/7. We need to be personalized and we need to be multi-platform. For us to do that, we rely on artificial intelligence to enable us to serve our customers in the right channels and the right way. So once again, AI being used in marketing and services, part of the value chain. Marketing could have had a million different opportunities, but I wanted to touch on one in particular, something that would be familiar to any of the retailers who are using e-commerce. We have a deep learning engine we've created as part of our customer analytics team called Ada. And what Ada is doing is helping us create hyper-personalized multi-channel marketing in the real world to normal people, not the professors. That means we're giving people messages they actually want to read. We're actually promoting products we think are more relevant for them. And again, this is all based on us using artificial intelligence to analyze the data we have. If people are products, if we know the way they live their lives, if we understand where they want to speak to us, we can use all of that information to deliver the next best action for them in real time across all of our platforms. So when it comes to marketing and targeting, again, AI can impact the way we operate. Claims. As I said, we hope 93 to 5% of our customers never use our product. This isn't a joke. This is an actual claims form from the 9th of March 2017. Can you believe this is actually how one of the world's biggest insurance companies is still doing claims? I don't know if any of you want to comment on who's at liability for this, but it's almost impossible to do. Yet we see new competitors coming into the market like Lemonade, who are able to analyze, again, the mobile sensory data to make an assumption on whether a claim using AI or a form of AI is valid within 3 seconds. I mean, they've embarrassed a lot of the big institutions with what they're doing here. And I think this is when we come to service and we come to loyalty and retention of our customers, using AI in claims is going to be pivotal to the way customers value the relationship with us moving forward. Underwriting. This is one of the hardest ones. This is where the actuaries for years have developed unique algorithms and risk profiling mechanisms to make sure that the risk we take on allows us to make profit at the end of the day. I couldn't get our version to work, so I'm using L&G's version of a selfie life insurance quote. But now they're taking life insurance, probably the most complicated policy to buy. I need your medical records. Have you ever smoked a cigarette? Did you ever stand in the sun for more than 15 minutes on 3 consecutive days? And in what, 15 seconds, L&G are using a selfie, facial image recognition, extracting medical data, my BMI, my age, my gender, directly from my image to underwrite me in that time. That isn't a fast-forwarded clip. That is a real-life example. And L&G aren't known for their innovation either. But let me, you know, this is a fundamental leap in the way we're doing underwriting. And this isn't just in life insurance. This goes across all of the product lines. And fraud. Any Israeli here has probably served in one of the military units. If we use AI to overlay the pattern data we're seeing on claims, whether it's whiplash or syndicates, we can start to detect fraud at a much higher level. I believe a third of the cost of all motor insurance in the UK for every single customer is related to whiplash claims, of which they reckon about 50% are fraudulent. If we can detect those patterns, if we can highlight those syndicates, if we can recognize people and locations and mobile phone numbers that are being repeated across claims, we can reduce the cost for every customer of a necessary evil, which is motor insurance. But I think the real value for us and where we think as a business is leading to is stringing all this together. So using next best action, using the right marketing tools and communication, we want to serve real-time quotes to our customers. And it's never a single vertical. It's never one piece of AI coming together. It's all about bringing together the most intricate amount of data we can and analyzing that in real time. And I just want to take you through a small journey to finish of just how we do that. We call this Ask It Never. Here's the lady who runs Ask It Never. She doesn't know I've used her for this example, but there she is. Wendy turns up on our website, and this is the process we go through to give her that quote of $108.90. We pull her work profile. We see what her title is and what she does. We use that to access other open source information on her from social media. From there, we get images. And using the images, we can start to do facial analysis to understand her personal profile, her behavioral profile. Is she happy or sad, anger or surprise? She'd probably be bloody angry if she knew I'd used her picture on this. And we can start to take a confidence score on how we feel she'll respond to the product we're pushing. We could start to take her facial imagery and use it to find other images of her to get a more accurate read on what we're doing. Then we can pull other information that we've got and pull together what we call a customer profile. We can use that to combine it with other products that she's holding, because a lot of people end up having Aviva products they never know about. And from there, start to extract more data about them to give a real composite view. Take her car registration, picture of her car. From there, we get her MOT details. From her MOT details, we can pull her address. From her address, we can pull a Google image of her home. From there, we can have a look at Zoopla and see what the property price is. From there, we can have a look at her kitchen. Not a real image. We can then look at her council tax band. We can overlay that with satellite imagery to see the lay of the land. We can have a look at the doctors in the area. We can have a look at the hospitals in the area. We can have a look at the violence and criminality in the area. We can have a look at the school and education levels in the area. We can combine that with road traffic safety data. We can combine that with geospatial property footprint data, slope data, aspect data, flood data. This is LIDAR data from to look at the gradient of the houses. As a matter of fact, we haven't even touched on mobile data. But when we combine it all together, we're looking at about 5,000 data points for one quote. And there is no way a human can process that in the right way, in the right time frame for our company to compete in the 21st century. When everything's now, when everything's in the moment, when Generation Z were feeling sorry for them because they have such high demands. DNA. Well, if you want to give up your DNA, I'll be sure we give you a really accurate quote on your life insurance. That's even before we start talking to startups who are trying to help us augment this, whether it's pattern data, other social media data, geospatial data, a platform for analyzing the data that we're collecting, fitness data, of course, our friends from Pixanai, and the next best action data. That's where we've got to. This is only possible if we're able to bring AI to analyze the emerging data we have in our world. And hopefully we can use that to make our products more relevant, give you the right products at the right time, and hopefully make you claim a little bit less.
Anthony, thank you, I think. It's a little known fact that before I joined the Foreign Office in 1992, I worked in insurance, in Royal Insurance in Liverpool for 18 months, and I can reassure you that the industry obviously hasn't moved on a jot since I worked with it 26 years ago. So, Ofri, you're up. Pixanai. So, Ofri, apparently you just jetted in from Barcelona. And he's going back to Barcelona. He's at the Mobile World Conference where Pixanai are nominated for the best AI. I hope you don't miss your award ceremony by being with us. One of the top 100 UK startups and one of the top 50 fastest growing companies in the UK. Ofri is going to talk about predictive personalization. Over to you, Ofri.
All right, thank you. Hope the snow doesn't stop. Just got some live pictures from Gatwick. Doesn't look too great. But so far, no delays, so we're good. But it's also snowing in Barcelona, by the way, so fair game. Thanks for the introduction. My name is Ofri from Pixanai. And as said, we're not going to talk too much about Pixanai today, but more about what it is that the field that Pixanai is in, or as we like to call it, hyper-personalization, and a bit about how AI and computer vision, we're using that to drive that forward. But before we dive into it, a little bit about myself. I also had a little stint in the government, so apologies, nobody's perfect. About 5 years ago, I was the senior marketing advisor to the Minister of Tourism in Israel, responsible for all out-of-home digital marketing, mobile, which then was on Flash, so it didn't really work. But, you know, ministries are always the last ones to adapt new tech. And one of my last tasks there was to launch a very segmented mobile campaign to Israel's two biggest tourist markets. Bit of trivia about Israel. For those of you who don't know, Israel's two biggest tourist markets are the evangelical community from the Bible Belt area of southern United States who come to walk where Jesus walked along the Galilee. And the second one is the gay and lesbian community who come to party in Tel Aviv, which was named third most open city in the world after Berlin and San Francisco in 2014. Both great markets, two phenomenal tourist markets to Israel, two markets you never ever want to confuse your messaging to, when you work in marketing. Could be quite drastic. The last words I heard was, make sure no evangelical priest sees an in-app ad to Tel Aviv Gay's Pride Parade. So I took that task on and started asking around to see what can we use to hyper-personalize these people on mobile devices. And being a senior marketing advisor to the minister, I got a lot of companies to come pitch me, same companies that today I have to bleed to get a minute with. You know, the Facebooks, the Googles, everybody comes and wants a piece of a contract with the government, trying to tell me how they hyper-personalize on mobile devices. And everybody's talking about the same spiel. So it's geolocation, time of day device, browsing patterns, social media listening, which, by the way, I believe to be one of the most secured ones. I don't know if you read the NFC report saying that there are more 18-year-old males on Facebook than there are 18-year-old males in the world. And that's just one glimpse of the obscurity of social media data. If you look at my social media feeds, you'd think I'm hugely into reflexology. And that's only because my wife's sister just opened up her own clinic, and if I don't share or like two of her posts a day, I get the couch. So that's all I share and post about on social media nowadays, and that's the security. So started to look at this mobile world about how can we actually personalize people and dive into it. And my background is in the service industry, so I'm really into, you know, the bartender speaking and knowing the guy coming in and telling him, I know exactly what whiskey you're going to drink tonight. So I started digging into it, and I came across a very interesting research called the Prince's Dilemma. Show of hands if you heard of the Prince's Dilemma. Okay, so don't give away the punchline. So I'll take you guys through it really quickly. The Prince's Dilemma speaks about two people, actual British people, that are on the same app at different times throughout their lives. We call them Person 1 and Person 2 for now, but we'll keep it like that. And then the Prince's Dilemma looks to see what can we find out about these two people based on online data that exists today in the world. So let's take a look at what we know about them. And this is all true data, by the way. So if you look at third-party data that we can buy from Oracle or Blue Kite today, or it's anywhere on the web, we can tell they're both male, both been married twice, grown children, young grandchildren. Great, so far they're the same kind of person. We can communicate with them the same. If we look at geolocation data that's available, we can tell they're both English, enjoy the countryside, love holidays in the Alps, and are extensive travelers. Great, so far I can hit them exactly the same. I know exactly how to communicate with both of them. If we look at social media listening, we can tell they're both born in 1948, love dogs, and are sports car fanatics. Fantastic. So far, they're still straight in the same category. And if I look at their purchasing behavior online, I can tell they're both part of the wealthier sector. Amazing. I can hit them both with the exact same content. I can communicate to them the exact same products. Any real Brits in the room? Right? Venture a guess who this data belongs to? The exactly similar, no other than Prince Charles and Ozzy Osbourne. And you can go back and check this data. Their online behavioral data is almost identical. Clearly, you don't want to be communicating or selling the same products to Ozzy Osbourne and Prince Charles. So I dove into this, and I started to look at what can we tell about them? Where can we find their differences? And one thing we realized is actually a great place to start would be their personal photo galleries that they have on their phone. Two things will happen. One, you'll be scarred for life, that's for sure. But two, if you could have full access to their personal photo galleries, you can start telling quite a lot of things about their personal life behaviors, such as how Prince Charles spends his evening versus how Ozzy does, how Prince Charles spends time with the family versus how Ozzy does. Great stuff. So we can really start to dig into it. And photos started to make sense to us. So we also took a look back at Marketing 101, and this goes back to what Anthony was saying, about the life cycle of people, right? We want to find them on these life events. And if we look at what used to be generation, a few generations before me, especially my dad, for example, people lived quite systematic lives, right? You went to university, you got a job, you got married, got a house, had two children, retired, and died, right? I mean, that was the extent. Sorry for dumbing down a bit, but that was the extent of the life points you wanted to interact with. But not only that, people living in the same community had similar patterns of life. We can tell that if you just finished a certain university, we can hit you with these kind of products, probably looking to get married and move on. But the reality is that all this is now out the door, right? With the new generation Z and moving forward, people are living much more drastic lives. As Ben said earlier, people switch jobs every 2 years, and our lives are starting to look a bit more confusing, right? We like to relocate. We want to have another job. We don't get married. We do get married. We travel the world, and we think that we own everything. But not only that, also the different people around have different lifestyle. We all want to create our own lifestyle. People that I grew up with in school, I don't live with them anymore, right? We all moved. I now live in London. We move all across the world. So the community doesn't really tell us a lot. But one thing does remain, and that's the actual life event. So if we extract the life events, they remain the same, right? We go through these processes. And the layer on top of it that is similar to all of them is that people today take pictures of everything. People self-document their life everywhere they go. It almost became the new form of communication. If we used to say that picture is worth 1,000 words, today we're taking umpteen amount of pictures of everything. In fact, part of our research shows that the item most photographed for 16 to 25-year-olds is socks. Which, I mean, I don't know how interesting that is for this talk, just an interesting fact to know. I don't think it's anything we thought about earlier. But it doesn't just make sense to look at photos from a theoretical perspective. It also makes sense from the numbers. People take on average 250 photos a month. Women on iPhone 6 is 360. That's just the data talking. The average phone holds about 1,500 photos continuously. It is the only offline connection between us and the device. It's the photos we take from our around day-to-day. And only less than 2% of those images end up on social media. which is really interesting because we care about the other 98% that's actually on your device. And at the end of the day, if you zoom out of your photo gallery, it actually looks like a data set along a timeline, right? Just a lot of little points along a timeline, which is what a really good data set is. So how do you analyze all these amazing photos and use them without going to jail the next day? That's an excellent question. And that's where PixNI comes in and trying to find these new points of data that we can interact with. So obviously a privacy-first technology, we wouldn't be talking to companies like Aviva or bank clients if we weren't. And this is where PixNI comes in, and this is the only bit of information about PixNI. But the idea here is very simple. If you look at the big giants of image of computer vision before, what they do is they look at the photo. This is our head of biz dev, not myself and his dog. They look to do image recognition on the photo itself, what's in the photo. And in order to do that, we need to extract the photo, obviously, to the cloud, analyze it, tag it, and bring it back. So use it for meta tagging and image search. What we've developed over the past 3 years, alongside with my co-founder, I mean, today there's 25 of us. My co-founder was head of computer vision at Samsung. They wrote the facial recognition algorithm for the camera that lives on there today. So very knowledgeable. And what we wrote was a way to actually train your device how to analyze its own photos. Starting with iPhone 4 and the Galaxy S4, devices became strong enough to run very complex image processors. And what PixNI does is it actually teaches... Ooh, that was some nice animation we missed there. PixNI actually teaches the device how to analyze its own photos, meaning that in no time do we see it, touch it, move it to a temporary folder. Everything stays on the device in order to extract a much deeper understanding about the user. Instead of telling you, is there a dog in the photo, we tell you, does the photo gallery owner have a dog? Same for me, for example, I don't have kids at home. I'm not a father, but my sister just gave birth and a few of my cousins, just a very reproductive time for the Ben Porat family. So I have a ton of photos of kids on my phone, if it's WhatsApp, if it's pictures that I took when I went to visit. But the architecture here has to be able to separate that from saying, okay, there are a lot of pictures of kids, but along the timeline of the photos, it doesn't make sense that it's my kids. So I'm not the father of the child. And that's how we developed this privacy-first technology. Everything lives and stays on the device. And it serves the hyper-personalization mechanism. We'll fly through these. These are just some interesting facts that we get from our market research about this before we dive into where we take this into prediction. But users no longer tolerate anything less than hyper-personalization. And this is only the beginning, because once you experience hyper-personalization, you never want to go back to any other brand that serves you anything less than that. And the greatest innovators, if you look at Facebook, Netflix, Amazon, they're built on the personalized experience. They're built on first-party data that you generate from them. And these things include preferences, actions, life events, hobbies, and also predictions. So how can this technology be used for the likes of insurance companies and the banking world? So we spoke about analyzing on device. What we've done is we've extracted a piece of data point that looks like this. So this is all we ever see. This is the PixNI feature vector. This is your entire photo gallery in a way that's explainable but not trackable, so we can't tell the features of the photo from the feature vector. So we'll just go for the sake of time. So what can we do with it? The first thing we can do is once we have this super abstract piece of data generated from today it's photos, tomorrow it's brainwaves from your chip that you have installed in your mind. But what we can do with that data is we can start to break it down into characteristics and just give a very nice list of characteristics. But that's just the surface. Where do we take it into predictions? Is when your photo gallery, because we're on the device, every new photo you take gets automatically analyzed on the device. And so we can start picking patterns, right? So when your photo gallery moves from this to this over the course of 9 months, right? Here it's too late to understand or to offer you anything that's predictive. But we can come 3 months before. So 3 months before you give birth today, PixNI can tell its clients, hey, there's an 85% chance that this person is about to have a baby in 3 months' time. This is the time to offer or start discussing or start communicating the right content to them. And it's true also to other things like moving home. So when your photo gallery goes from this to this, there's a very strict pattern when you're about to move home. So 3 months before you move, pictures of empty rooms, furniture standalone, print screens of floor plans, pictures of houses from the outside in different geolocation, we can start predicting the move of the home 3 months before. That's it for Ofri. You guys have been a great audience. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day. See you at the conference.
I've got a few questions about that, but we'll hold those for the Q&A session afterwards. So, Roshan, you're up from RBS.
Please do. Yeah, there he is, Paul.
So we've been working again with RBS for quite some time. RBS have got a substantial footprint in Israel via their fintech incubator, The Floor, who actually poached one of our staff from the UK Israel Tech Hub. So thanks again for that, Roshan. Over to you, RBS.
Okay. Thank you, guys. So just a little bit about myself. I mean, I work in the Central Innovations team, so I'm basically there to kind of execute on a lot of the innovation kind of challenges that we have from the businesses and all the rest. So just to give you a little bit of kind of history, in 2017, I mean, what I did was I set up a design group, which was a kind of a cross-bank functional design group with respect to kind of, you know, providing education for the firm and also looking at toolkits and skills and business cases and big data. I mean, the purpose of all of this was really to try to understand exactly what we were trying to do with respect to, you know, our artificial intelligence agenda. At present, though, what we've done is what we're trying to, you know, we've set up a platform right now, which essentially is to kind of look at, you know, design principles around how do we actually do artificial intelligence properly. I think the big challenge with a bank is essentially that not only are we very glacial, but getting the kind of the structure right to do this properly has been a bit of a problem. So what we've done is we've set up principles which, you know, follow this kind of established kind of common taxonomy. So really, how do we get everyone in the firm to kind of talk the same language? Because we've got all these people around the firm rushing into artificial intelligence, trying to do all this kind of really exciting stuff, but nobody really talks the same language. We're not really approaching it from kind of the same kind of platform or mantra. And what we've decided to do is we've set up these centres of excellence. We've got a centre of excellence which we're running, machine learning in one of our engineering teams, and we've got a centre of excellence for RPA. And what essentially that does is that's providing us with the fabric and the framework to kind of, you know, basically do all this kind of stuff properly. And it gives us the ability to kind of, you know, have all the business teams leverage this central unit to essentially, you know, use all the capabilities that we've developed internally. Following these kind of architectural design patterns. So really what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to create a simple architectural framework in the bank. And what that really means is if we can, like, use solutions, so if we're scouting or developing internal capabilities, if we can essentially use singular solutions and deploy them across the bank, that's really where we're trying to get to. And we want things to be kind of collaborative. We want things to be repeatable. We want to basically be able to manage this. And we want to govern it all properly. So that's what we're doing with kind of like the structure of how we're trying to do artificial intelligence. We're trying to make it much more cohesive and centralized. One of the big things that everybody knows about really is also obviously having the people. I mean, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to upskill on our data science capability. We're trying to build out, you know, our ability to kind of leverage the cloud as well. So we want to have all our technologies up there. And we want to ensure that our frontline staff, that when we actually put stuff into production, we can actually do this kind of stuff properly. And then moving into kind of like, you know, I suppose governance is also a really big challenge for us. I mean, really, when we look at using a lot of solutions and looking at things like GDPR, we need to make sure that we have the right governance framework around it. So we're doing a hell of a lot of stuff. We're moving very, very quickly. But what we've actually got to do as well is we've got to make sure that not only are we managing what we're doing properly, but we have the right kind of governance framework in place as well, so to make sure that we're using the data properly. Because what we're kind of seeing right now is that there's a lot of data around the firm, and people like Paul, obviously, who will talk a little bit later about data innovation. We're accessing a lot of data. We're using a lot of data to do a lot of studies, but we have to police it properly, and that's a bit of a challenge that we have, you know, across the organization. So really, what we're trying to do here is have a framework, centers of excellence, control how we use the data, make sure that we have the governance in place, ensure that we have the right people skills, so that we have all the engineers in terms of the data science capability and the people who can actually use the tools. We've got to essentially make sure that we have the kind of the ability to control our models. So when we're actually developing these models and we're iterating these models, you know, how do we put them into production? How do we test them? How do we make sure that they're actually performing and evaluate them properly? So we kind of need that kind of model librarian and these platforms to control that. So that's another thing that we're looking at essentially as well, to put in, you know, the tools and the solutions to control how we develop the models, how we test them, and then how we put them into production, then how we pull them out. And one thing that we're actually trying to do in the data innovation team right now as well, which is something which is very important, especially in my side of the fence, is to kind of make sure that we centralize the test data, because we need to do things quickly. So one thing about having a framework which is important to do a lot of innovation is we need to have the capability to allow us to use the data very quickly, is to have that available to be able to obfuscate that data and be able to run the tests and basically, you know, put things into production, which is the big challenge that we have. Now, I know that this is one thing that people don't really like, the kind of like the compartmentalization of how we do machine learning and predictive analytics. And what we're trying to do here, following on from our peers at IBM who keep selling us all this wonderful advice, is that we have kind of broken things down into looking at discover and compare and comply and advanced analytics. What that does is it's been giving us a framework to be able to kind of control how we approach what solutions we're using and how we're actually targeting how to do this stuff properly. And in the discovery, what we look at here is really looking, so we're looking at the unstructured data side here and really looking at, you know, how do we find answers and derive insights from what that data is actually telling us. And some of the examples, which Paul will kind of exaggerate on a little bit later, is really looking about automating kind of the channel analysis. So we're looking a lot at chat, we're looking at email, we're looking at telephony. And the thing that we're trying to do here is we're trying to look at, you know, customer attributes, we're looking at, you know, preferences, we're looking at, you know, behaviors and all the rest so that we can actually get the right insights, deliver the right products and the right services to people. And a big part of what we're doing right now is on the AML stuff, which we'll touch upon. But, you know, AML has been a big part of the discovery piece for us right now, which we're actually working with an Israeli innovator at present on that. Compare and comply. We're looking at looking at kind of contract analysis. So using a lot of machine reading and machine learning techniques to extract information from contracts. We're doing quite a lot of that in terms of looking, obviously, at legal. We're doing that in the KYC piece as well when we're doing kind of comparative analysis between financial and management information. We are doing a lot of that work in the regulatory compliance and attestation piece as well. So the compare comply piece is moving forward quite a lot at RBS. And then advanced analytics. So really in the advanced analytics and the machine learning here, we are doing a lot of personalizations. We're doing a lot of work in personalization. We're looking at also kind of the preemption of undesired behaviors. And we're doing a lot of predictive modeling when it comes to things like pricing. So when we look at things, for example, like the mortgage area, we're doing a lot of predictive analytics on our mortgage books and looking to look at, you know, product attribution modeling, you know, price optimization, which has been a big part of my workflow. But I'm going to hand over to Paul, who's going to just give you a little bit of an oversight into data innovation and some of the use cases that we're looking at without being overly proprietary.
Cool. Thanks, Roshan. So I'm Paul Ward. I work in the data innovation team, which we got the luxury of basically not having to do all the, all the boring bits of produce all the reports and analytics out of the wider function for the bank and really working with Roshan, the external network, and then across all the areas of the business to, first of all, I guess, figure out the intersection of new ideas and demands the business have got with, novel techniques and tools. There's a couple of things we're trying to achieve. First of all is more incremental benefit to pay the bills, if you like, in terms of efficiency, efficacy of decision-making and intelligence. But then really look for some of the more disruptive step change things we can bring into the bank as well. Some of the areas Roshan's touched on, I'll just give you a flavour of the sorts of things we're looking at across our portfolio at the moment, and why, probably more importantly. So credit and risk, you mentioned on it there. One area I think is really interesting is on early warning indicators. So this is prior to things like credit events, customers getting into difficulty. How can we help the customers and help ourselves in terms of predictive analytics to try and spot that stuff happening? The obvious information to use there is on our financial data, payments data, things that we, of course, already have. But we're also trying to look at expanding that out into other information that we can bring in from third parties, via the customer or otherwise, even out into things like social physics and social media, that sort of thing. Another, hot area is on servicing customers well and better. Obviously, it's a big banter of RBS if you've seen the advertising. And particularly, again, there's a very, I'm sure people have gone through it, phoning up large organisations and banks, quite convoluted processes and steps you go through if you're trying to get things done and end up complaining about them when you can't get things done. We're trying to look at that, trying to figure out how we could use, there's a lot of data we have internally around that, but how can we actually use and analyse that data to first of all help to classify better what's going on, and secondly actually to start predicting and intervening earlier up the chain to help people out and stop these things happening before they become big problems for people. Because often these things are very simple at the root cause. It might be you walk into a bank branch and you couldn't get something done and they have to refer it on and nobody hears back for days and. So the more we can understand that at scale with the data we've got and use machine learning to fix it. Couple of areas. One is really getting better actionable intelligence, both directly to our customers. So it might be high net worth individuals in private banking, for example, or to ourselves, to our relationship managers to engage with business banking customers. So that's not just the press the button on the CRM system. It's actually a lot more, can we understand what's going on in their lives? Can we get third-party data in public sources? Could be events at companies' house to do with companies. It could be information from ratings agencies, all sorts of novel sources. We're trying to look to augment the data set we have internally on that. And then finally, something that's interesting, I know it's going to come up as well later, starting to look at a lot more deep network analysis, and I don't mean neural nets, although it's relevant, but networks of individuals, networks of behaviours, networks of people, networks of payments, from a number of angles. One which is, I guess, fairly obvious is AML, money laundering, fraud, us trying to get smarter at understanding behaviour patterns and what's going on to improve the efficacy of what we do and also the efficiency. We spend a huge amount of time internally chasing down false positives and dealing with all that stuff. So looking at that. And probably another angle is quite not yet well understood, let's say, and we're pursuing it, is really to understand the economic relationships between all sorts of parties. So if you took Carillion as an example, obviously understanding the whole chain of events that led up to that, who's connected to who, supply chain, et cetera, and having a much more sophisticated understanding of the behavioural dynamics of all the parties involved that will allow us to manage risk better. That gives you a flavour of the sort of things we're doing.
No, I think what's pretty clear though from our side is that we're trying to basically do this systematically. So really to kind of achieve things at scale. So running through a lot of the use cases, when there's so many use cases that we have in the bank, but really what we need to do is we need to have an operating model whereby lots of different people and lots of different teams in the bank kind of work together. So what we're doing is we've integrated data innovation. We have our architectural team. We have design engineering, innovation solutions. And we have all the business teams. What happened last year was we had a lot of disparate conversations. People were running around very quickly trying to do a lot of cool stuff with data and with a lot of the tools. What that meant was we couldn't really have a lot of control. We couldn't have like one voice. Now, what I'm not saying here is we shouldn't have, say, an engineering team or an architectural team that runs all of AI, because we don't want that to happen either, because then what happens is you get heavily influenced by a team that wants to be a lot of control. We lose the agility, and then we can't really be innovative per se, if you like. So what we've done is by having these kind of models and having this platform, we can do things much more systematically. And as Paul said, what we're doing with a lot of the use cases that we have is that we're trying to supplant the learnings that we gain from these particular use cases and have a kind of an architectural design pattern that we can then deploy across the firm. Because bear in mind, we are a big bank, so we're not like a small agile startup. We can move in multiple directions, or even an SME, which we do a lot of things. We work very glacially, and we have a lot of governance, and we have a lot of paranoia, not at the top of the firm, but just generally through the firm anyway, a lot of paranoia that we have to alleviate, and we have to therefore have a lot of control. And we also will be getting a lot of questions from our customers, and that means that we know we need to be able to answer the questions. And there's only, as you all in this room know, there's a very sort of elite room to be fair. I mean, there's only a certain kind of proportion in the organization who have that data science capability, who have that deep dive knowledge of what models are, what they do, how they train, how you manage these models. So if you're putting models into production, you need to make sure that at the base level, there's a conversation going on where people can explain how they work, how they operate, and the efficiency, and how we improve them and all the rest. So apart from having tools that can have these model libraries and all the rest, we need to make sure that the human beings in the firm kind of can control the stuff. So a very good example, which kind of leads into what some of the work we've done in NanoRep, is we did a lot of work in chat, as people know, and it's public, and we've used IBM Watson as the kernel, and we call it Cora. Now, I think this is not an example of doing kind of deep dive AI, which is, you know, genius work and all the rest. It's not. It triages conversations at three levels. It answers basic queries. What it has done is it's done two things. It's made sure that from an operational perspective, we are moving in the right direction. So we can basically handle conversations, you know, based on text interaction with a human being and a customer and someone in the bank, you know, 18 times faster. Well, hey, that's great, but it is actually very good because it increases kind of the throughput. The second thing that we're actually doing here and what we've proven is that, you know, we can handle, you know, hundreds or 200 basic queries, which is something obviously that capacity that human beings don't do. So reducing obviously overhead and again, you know, customer service impact and net, promoter scores are much better. But really for me, before we discuss, you know, really going into, you know, what we've done is really about we've proven that we can do this at scale. Part of this was to kind of look at, can we actually do AI, even if it's base AI, can we actually implement this in an organization and run it across a firm of 100,000 people and deploy it across different franchises, different departments and manage it properly? So move it from the innovation, you know, the egg or the idea that we had right the way through to productionization with engineering and architecture, now kind of firmly in control. And we have done that. So we have, which many of you may have seen, we have, you know, Cora, which is operating in CPB, which is our commercial and our private bank. We have it in our personal bank, in the mobile banking. We have it in web chat. This is the laundry list. We are integrating Cora with Amazon Alexa for Ulster Bank. So we're trying to evolve the kind of the conversational piece even further now. And we're using it in other areas. I think one thing that we've also seen as well is things like containment rates. You know, we thought it'd be around about 30%. Sorry for throwing all the statistics at you. We thought it'd be around about 30%, but it's moving towards, you know, 40 to 50%, which is a big tick in the box from an operational standpoint. And many of you may have seen the thing on the BBC website, which was RBS is using a solution called Soul Machines, which is kind of the avatar and all the rest, which looks a little bit scary. So we're now evolving that as well. So you can actually have a conversation with somebody who looks relatively human, if you haven't been to Glasgow. But you can have a conversation with somebody who looks relatively human. And we're also doing Ask Archie, which is a virtual assistant for all the employees, and we're integrating with when we're asking questions with HR and all the rest. So Cora is a great example of something that we've done at scale, and, you know, Nick will go on about, you know, how we've worked with his company NanoRep on that. I wasn't going to do a huge amount on this because I know that you guys have been talking about it, but I'm just going to sort of fly the flag for the kind of the RBS Israeli interaction here. It has been a very successful collaboration from 2014 through to present day. So bear in mind the proximity of where Israel is compared to when we scout in London. There's a huge amount of amazing solutions in London, and, you know, there's a lot in the US a little further away. You know, Israel's proved to be a very fertile ground. Now, I mean, there's many reasons for that. Well, I mean, a few which I'll touch upon. But bear in mind, since 2014, RBS has gone to Israel, I think, 9 times. In the last 2 years, my boss, and not inviting me, has gone to Israel about 3 or 4 times. Yeah, so the solutions that we've reviewed, now we've basically scouted 321 companies in Israel. And you might say, well, you can meet companies all the time. But these companies have a direct relevance to business cases that we're working on. So we've been very particular, very focused, and very sort of systematic and deliberate in what we've done. What's been shown in Israel is that when we're planning these agendas and we're executing, that the people on the ground there have really understood the nature of the problems at hand, produced the best of breed companies, and really helped us integrate with some of the best startups on the ground over in Tel Aviv, which has been absolutely fantastic. The cooperation agreements that we have in place with two banks over there, I think it's Bank Hapoalim and Luemi, have been very productive, and we've been running tech exchanges over here and bringing Israeli innovators into the UK, which has obviously done well as well. But what is remarkable is the fact that we have... bear in mind, getting something into production and we're a POC and a pilot in a bank is very difficult. We've had 17 POCs and pilots in what is, you know, 4 years with Israeli innovators, and that is very commendable given that, you know, we have, you know, presence in Silicon Valley and across Europe, and we haven't had the same conversion ratio that we have had from Israel. And we have basically put, I can't say exactly how many because it's a rare graduate, but we put more than 5, let's say, solutions into production within that time frame, which is a big, big achievement. And the reason for that, I think, you know, from my own perspective and having worked with a lot of companies over in Israel, is because of the collaborative nature of the startups that are there. I think that when we go to people and we ask them, or we show them that we have a challenge or we have an opportunity, the Israeli innovators have tended to work with us and partner with us and actually get, you know, their hands dirty with what we're trying to achieve here. So that's been absolutely fantastic. It's very commendable. It's kind of the way that we would like to work with a lot of innovators and startups across the world, to actually have them come into the office, work with us, and engage with us in live conversation, which, Paul, you've witnessed yourself. And in January 2018, this slide is just throwing a lot of color at you and a lot of names. But in January 18, this is just an example of how we kind of structure our trips over there with third parties. So working with the Israeli Tech Hub and our partners on the ground. And there's a lot of companies up there that we continue to work with, and many of which we will be bringing to POC and potentially pilot.
So again, it's been great. And here's just some of the, my former boss maybe put this slide in, basically to sort of prove, you know, how amazing, the job has been and some of the references that we've had from people on the ground. So that's Abby Cohen from the floor, who's saying how wonderful the relationship's been. We've had, Haim Shani from the Israel Growth Partners as well, who's commending the relationship. And also, the British ambassador has basically stated that, you know, as I said, that, you know, my firm has been going over to working in Israel, we're probably one of the best firms in terms of progressing this in our interaction with the community over in Tel Aviv. So again, it's been great. And that's me flying the flag for that relationship. And that's us, unless you have anything else to add, Paul? No? Okay. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks. Roshan, thanks for those final three slides, for mentioning and including those. We work quite hard on those slides, so thanks for including those in your comments. Right, Nick from NanoRep, Bold 360 AI. Bold 360 AI is so innovative that I've just tried to access their website on my government-issued smartphone, and it was blocked. So it's either really innovative or really scary. Over to you.
Okay, thanks. Great, okay. Hi, everyone. So I thought I'd start off with, thank you, Roshan, for that. And Roshan pretty much covered, I think, some of the bits that I was going to cover very lightly. But I'm kind of working on the basis that this wasn't really a business sell. This was really more about, you know, the technology and, I guess, you know, the technology and how it's applied to industry. But I thought I'd start off with just some observations, because it's quite refreshing to hear all the different presentations and, I guess, the subject matter. And there's a lot of experts in the room, and it's quite a privilege to be here, to be honest with you. But, you know, AI is going to take everybody's jobs. There's fear of being fired. Big data is still at an early stage, although it started to become very useful. I think we've seen that certainly in the insurance sector. This me society is so interesting. And, Ben, I need to talk to you, because I think that there's somebody that you should talk to from Monster who would be very, very useful for your business. But I agree, the me society is, you know, very much relates to Who Moved My Cheese, actually, which is a really interesting book that I recommend everybody reads. We've heard about intelligent learning and remote education. And, you know, can we leave our future generations on their own to learn and grow as individuals? I think YouTube has answered a lot of the queries around that. And then there's personalization, which is, you know, how does AI help us in our everyday life? How do you apply change? And certainly for the me society, has it become a lot more relevant to me? There's a big question around GDPR, which I haven't heard about, which, you know, is definitely something to be thought about in relation to the application of access to AI. And I want to touch upon the sort of Israeli connection for a minute. So NanoRep is an Israeli company that's been taken over, actually. It's been acquired by a company called LogMeIn. LogMeIn have set up this business unit called Bold 360. Now, I joined NanoRep a year ago. It's my first experience of working with Israelis. And some of these names, WeWork, Amdocs, Nice Systems, Way, WorkKey, Pixani, these are the companies of the future. Look how they've grown. I think it's an amazing energy that you get when you go to Israel. And the relationships that I've built and the technology that I've seen coming from the country is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm really, really excited about what I do, who I work with. I still work very closely with Israelis. And, yeah, have a lot of energy because of that. But still, all of this wonderful stuff. And my four-year-old still owns the remote, and she doesn't sleep at night. So there's got to be some proper application of this stuff for other pragmatic reasons, right? Okay, so let me just kind of jump into my presentation. So I think some of the things that I've talked about kind of relate to the usefulness of this information and access to information. And there's a real perception that I get to experience and sort of feel when I'm communicating with a lot of our large organizations who have challenges when they want to make communicating with their customers or their customers' customers a lot more efficient. And there's this perception that, you know, bots are these hardwired things that are, you know, they're Android-like and, you know, quite one-dimensional. So I thought, well, how about the sort of harmony between AI and humans, and how do you build out on that? So my background is I've worked for startups, and I've also worked for enterprise organizations. My role before NanoRep was focused around intelligent search. So it's language-based search is really my background and experience. So NLP primarily. And I head up a business called Bold 360 AI. So we work with organizations like RBS, and we help them serve their customers by delivering a digital platform that recognizes customer intent. And this is through language input, this is through search, this is through bots, whether they're conversational, whatever they may be. So I'm going to talk a little bit about... the landscape. The landscape of the contact center, actually. And this is a B2C environment. So this is the operational landscape of where we are now in terms of a customer support operation and where it's going. So this is a review by Gartner that was done last year. And what's quite interesting here is that, you know, self-service, so this is FAQs, these are kind of bots and, you know, channels that actually support customers getting their information. It's actually quite high in 2017. It's moved a lot over the last couple of years, but it's increased massively, or it's going to increase massively over the next few years. But interestingly, there's this space in the middle now where it's about agent-assisted self-service, and that's something that I'm going to talk a little bit more about. So if we think about, you know, the history of how we supported our customers, it was very much binary. It was basically a telephone historically. It moved to becoming a contact center, so you could email your organizations or whoever you were getting your services from. And now we find there's a message center. So, you know, messaging has increased 400% over the last 2 years. So if you think about how you communicate with brands as an individual now, there are so many channels, they're just exploding. I mean, WhatsApp has just launched another channel. Everybody's now fighting. There's Apple Chat, there's Live Chat, there's messaging. There's so many channels now where you can communicate with a brand. For organizations, this is a big, big challenge. So what we see happening is this transition where actually it becomes a bot first that's going to deal with your query. And ultimately, a bot is going to recognize more about you and the way you are anticipating the next step of your interaction taking place. And this transition is very much about moving away from these kind of common tasks to looking at really emotional intelligence. And when we talk about emotional intelligence, it's a big transition that's taking place between technology assisting humans to humans assisting technology. This is about productivity. What we're moving towards is really more around customer experience. And we all know that if the customer experience is right, then it creates brand empathy. Brand empathy is really, really important. Because if you move and you transition away from having, you know, somebody who's communicating with you that's just talking about kind of common FAQ type queries that then moves across to actually proactively contacting you about whether it's your policy, whether it's, you know, an upgrade for a phone, whether it's something that's relevant to you and important to you, that then creates a better customer experience. So it moves from being very much about human, human to bot to human. And, you know, historically or even now, we can see around sentiment analysis and behavioral patterns, the kind of, you know, customer intent to a degree. But when you start to think about the customer experience, it really starts to become an outside-in and conversational experience. And this is very much about the me society. So the new millennials or the millennials and the new customer adoption that's taking place, and it's really interesting in terms of what Ben's talking about, because it's the reverse of LinkedIn. This is very much about, okay, so I'm the guy with the money now. I'm the guy who is in control. Drive your organization to work with me, rather than me driving myself to work with your organization. And this is about an outside-in approach. And it becomes conversational in the sense of you should recognize who I am, you should recognize what I'm about to do and how I'm about to communicate with you, and that drives value. And those that don't get that right are going to die. It's quite simple. This is our what we call our voices dashboard. So there's some machine learning that's taking place here. And actually we're... Do you want to click that? So what's happening here, these are all different bots that are actually communicating. If we can get it up. So these are bots that are communicating through lots of different channels. And there's recognition whether the bot is actually answering the question and the query correctly or not. And you'll see here there's a resolved, unresolved, and channeled. And this is, you kind of, on a social feed, you can get a sentiment analysis and all of that's fine. That's been around for some time. But this is a little bit more acute because it's talking specifically about the brand and representing the brand and representing the query that's taking place. It looks like it's lagging, so I think we're short on time. But you can see this dynamically showing in real time. So as an organization and a business, you can see the value that's being contributed through the interactions that are taking place with your customers in real time. If there's a sea of reds taking place, then you've got big trouble. So this happened with a network outage with a major telco of ours. We started to see a lot of red in a particular region. It might look quite binary, but there's actually some really strong analytical information behind here around the sentiment, around the data that's being captured. The important thing is these insights that are coming through, we're constantly learning from. So with an organization like RBS, they have some elements of the capabilities that we've got here, but we're showing a lot of insight in terms of where the improvements can be made, where the gaps are happening, and how the business is performing. And this is very much driving this outside-in approach from customers. Yeah. Okay. So I'm just gonna walk through very quickly, a little bit more of an explanation in terms of what I mean here, because it's about context that we're talking about here. There may be two people asking the same question, but unless you've got all of this right on the right-hand side, and we've heard a lot about it, I think, from Aviva, context is everything, right? Relevancy of everything, whether it's pictures, whether it's language, whether it's geolocation, whether it's travel, whether it's your suitcase lost, whether it's your kids, whatever it might be, you can still ask a question twice in a very, very, or the same question in a very, very different way. So getting that right and making it conversational is actually quite a hard thing to do. And our platform was moved from being NLP to NLU and actually a stage further. So we can recognize customer intent through language. Okay? We can also recognize natural language understanding, which is about understanding where somebody wants to go. And actually, if the conversation then becomes more problematic, we use RPA, and then using NLU again, we can drive context. So this is a flow that I was actually going to show a demo, but I didn't know whether I had authority to do it from RBS, so I bottled it. but this is, so if we look at the flow of this, somebody's booking a flight, so they get to the point where they're saying, okay, and to Goa. So this is not about just recognizing the next question. This is recognizing the history of the question that's taken place. So should I order a veggie meal and window seat as usual? So this is then about the me society, right? This is about recognizing and learning from who this customer is from previous interactions that have taken place. And if we can do that, we know that they're a frequent flyer. We know their profile. We can then start to serve them the content that's really relevant to them. This is not a whole load of FAQs that they're flying through. This is a conversational experience. Sorry, this is not possible. This is unacceptable. Sentiment analysis. Okay, so this is now a real problem, because what do we do with this customer who's about to kick off? We bring a human in. And this is very much about that previous slide that I showed around having a technology-led an AI-led experience, but actually combine it with human. So this is the harmonization that's now taking place. So we then go back and, you know, somebody completes their journey. So the mind map here is quite important, because what we're doing is we're really looking at essentially mirroring the cognitive experience of the way that we're processing information. So we've mapped this out to include intent, context. Well, I'm not going to read it all, but if we are able to structure the customer information and help the customer in such a way that it becomes complementary to their profile, their needs, then, you know, harmony can take place. And this is starting to happen now, and it's starting to happen with a lot of our very large clients and very large organizations. So I think if there's any message that I wanted to leave everybody with today, is that the application of AI in terms of understanding customer intent and the direction that organizations are able to go in terms of self-service, it's starting to become a lot more emotional, a lot more driven towards brand relevancy. And so I'll leave you with harmony between bots and humans. Thank you.
Nick, thanks. So I think we've got about 5 minutes for questions. I've got lots, but I'll let the audience go first. So, question over here.
With this very vast collection of 5,000 data points on anybody who makes a query, how close are you to a universal personalized pricing of products so that everybody pays differently? And what effects do you think that might have?
I'm not an actuary, but what I would say is there is some regulatory boundaries, and there is some challenges around using the data and information we can get. One thing is having the data available. There's a second thing about being able to use it wholesale across an estate, and RBS touched on some of the challenges of whether it's GDPR, compliance, governance, regulation. I mean, Ofri could tell you some horror stories of how long it's taken us to bring Pixnet into a limited pilot within our business. I think the capabilities exist. Making them available to 33 million customers in the UK at an enterprise grade level is more challenging. And our lawyers and our governance people are particularly concerned, as is the regulator. But yeah, we could. I think personally, I'm not an actuary, but from what I know, there is enough data in existence within our estate to be able to give people much more personalized policies as opposed to grouping them in risk profiles. That exists. We see it already in the motor space with switch on, switch off insurance. Same with travel. So it's only a short amount of time before we move that into other product lines.
Sorry, if I could follow up.
Sure.
Personalized pricing of insurance policies that depend on people's behavior is kind of a social good, because it encourages everybody to be secure Susan instead of, I don't know what the other person character was. But personalized prices of anything you want to buy, as might be possible with Pixnet, seems a much more interesting question as to whether this would be good or bad and where it is. I'm very interested.
Is that follow up for me or offer?
I was just to make sure I understand the question. So you want to know if that's to predict the purchasing behavior or the lifestyle of it. So what was the question?
What?
What was the question at the end?
This hyper personalization seems to imply, as a logical endpoint, hyper personalized pricing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's where, and it starts with pricing. It goes to credit scoring. And understanding of the human. So if you look at somebody from a different culture, so we work today across the world, and what we realize is cultural differences is a big notion in pricing as well, especially in biases. And somebody who lives in Nigeria, for example, to get credit will be judged based on Western values of what credit scoring is or what the pricing should be, might actually be biased based on any other data. But if you look at their photo data or you start to hyper-personalize them, you realize that in fact, they wake up every morning, they go to work, they come back home, and they go to work, except their work might be a bit different or might visually look a bit different on a risk assessment sheet, might look a little different. But in fact, it'd be very same. And so yes, personalized pricing is something specifically around life event predictions. So if you're expecting a child, for the prices of those things to go down versus if it's your second child, if it's your first home or your second home. I definitely believe in personalized pricing.
Can I follow on that? So insurance companies have typically not been very transparent with the way that we price people, right? And changing customer behavior is a particularly hard thing to do. People have heart attacks, yet you see them outside the hospital smoking a cigarette. So changing the right behaviors to reflect their insurance premium is a particularly hard challenge, as most people don't seem to actually care about the insurance policies they take. This is a fact. What's even more interesting is the actual things that predict risk. And a good example would be, we take more indication on people's likelihood to make a property claim from the way they keep their front garden than we do for perhaps more obvious factors like, do you have a lock on your window? So it's also, are we going to encourage people to get into making sure the front of their house looks nice as opposed to putting locks on the window? The answer is probably no. But it's also understanding about using it to have more personalized prices different to changing the factors and behaviors that influence it. And they're two different kind of challenges.
So we've got a question over here. And then we'll take these two questions together, maybe.
I'm always struck when I hear presentations such as the one that I've just heard about how a lot of what you're doing, the back-end stuff is very similar to what we try and do to help people learn. You're trying to personalize the experience, and that's what a lot of education is about. The difference is we can't do that with education unless we can explain the personalization to the individual whom we're interacting with, because they need to understand what's going on in terms of their learning, if they're going to benefit from it. Now, with the increasing emphasis on a lot of the inquiries that are happening, certainly in the UK and in Europe, on transparency, explainability, how are all or any of you going to deal with that issue of transparency and explainability to a general population who will not understand much of what the technology behind the systems is?
Great. Second question. So today we've had a lot of talking about AI assistance in all kinds of areas, for example, mortgaging, education, and so on. Question is, how do you guarantee the correctness of the underlying machine learning methods? How do you guarantee these algorithms are fair and unbiased? So I assume all these products are proprietary. And so how do you avoid disasters? I mean, there are really bad examples from the U.S. In court trials of proprietary software where it was just bad engineering. So how do you avoid these kind of things if Google can't even get this right?
Okay. They're connected. Yeah. Ofri, maybe the first question?
Yeah. No, I was going to answer the last one. I think, and Paul may jump in here. I think it's about just controlling the pace in terms of execution right now. I mean, we don't, as I was describing before, that if you look at the construct of the employee base or the setup that we have internally, you know, if you compare, say, an investment bank to a retail bank, investment banks tend to be stacked full of, you know, statisticians, people with computational statistics backgrounds, you know, PhDs in engineering, et cetera. We don't have that luxury on the retail side. And I think that a lot of the companies that we meet tend to be staffed by people in this room who are very smart, who can build algorithms and mathematical kind of methodologies which allow us to do funky things with data and produce, you know, not just insights, but recommendations, et cetera, to customers. The problem is that the vast majority of the people in the organization do not come from those backgrounds. And therefore, part of it's about model management, model control. But the other part of it really, and as I say, you know, Paul can jump in about qualification of the underlying methodology or algorithm. We need people to go in there and actually qualify what we're doing is operate with efficiency. So if we've got, I mean, an example I used in AML, for example, there were three different solutions we were looking at. Each solution came out with three different outcomes, and we analyzed, you know, when we were in theory analyzing data, which one do you use? And that can happen again, different permutations of study, you have different outcomes. And if the regulator asks us, why did you pick solution A over B and C? We need to intelligently respond as to why we did that. And if we can, then, you know, they're going to say to us, well, how are you doing this at scale in other areas of the bank? And so I think part of it's about, and this is my opinion, I think part of it's about human capital, and I think part of it's about having a systematic approach to how we actually qualify solutions, whether we build them internally or we use them from, you know, third parties. Does that answer it, sort of?
All that thought. Offering.
So just yeah. So
happens to moderate
the first question. Yeah. Go ahead. Two things on that. First of all, and we'll touch about transparency because that's what we deal with 24/7. We have, I think we're the youngest company to have three internal heads of regulations for a startup that's, you know, 2 years old. That's quite crazy. So we'll talk about transparency, but just about the mistakes algorithms make. And that, I mean, when you're going to analyze data, the relevancy of what you're using it for, that's where it matters. So I'm not going to decide whether to disconnect a main artery based on my AI algorithmic data, but as if I'm working with a telco to offer a client free service to move his landline to a new home that I'm predicting he's probably buying, if I'm 85% accurate on that and I missed on 15% of the population and I just push notified, I don't know, 2 million people about if they'd like help moving their landline for their recent home moves and they're not moving homes and they hit ignore or decline, the ability to decline irrelevancy today is quite simple. So I'm not too worried about that. When we start using it for other crazy things we talk about you know, the Iron Dome and stuff like that and the mistakes and the algorithms there could have other repercussions. But I think if we're talking about retail use cases, I think the outcomes are still within the space. And about transparency, I think I tried to ask once our head of regulations, what is GDPR on one foot? And they said as long as there's full consent from a user who fully understands what you're asking for him. All right, good. That's what I'm here for. Stirring the pot. I'm just going to drop that and then run to the airport. No, but it's the transparency here is about making sure. So I don't know if you read the Google Terms and Services. They've just recently changed it, literally, I think, 2 weeks ago, where it starts off by trying to start explaining, saying about accessing your photo gallery. It says, computers don't see photos like humans do. And it almost sounds like a start of a good movie, but there is a lot of effort to start and doing it. And as long as these consents are not just, Aviva would like access to your photo gallery, but Aviva would like to offer you a much better service. There's a give-get relationship, as in reduced life insurance based on your lifestyle. We will do this by mapping data on your device, such as your personal photo galleries. At no time will Aviva see your photos, touch your photos, or move them anywhere. You've got to start somewhere with pushing these boundaries a bit.
Can I jump in? We are hugely cautious on everything we do about consent, about data protection, about security, and everything related to governance. Actually, to our detriment a lot of the time, our inability to take advantage of emerging trends is hampered by the fact that we are too scared of the potential, what we call it, the Daily Mail headline, of what it might say about the company if something went wrong. The problem with that is you'll get challengers coming to the market who don't operate at the same boundaries and regulation, and they will steal customer base, which is fine. They can have, but they won't provide the customers with the same security. So there is almost a need for the established players to be innovative, to validate some of these technologies and things, to ensure there is kind of a standard across certain industries, especially with something like insurance that is particularly complicated. And I think it's important that we have the safe zones to try these things. That's why we have proof of concepts. That's why we have pilots. A lot of the time we do them internally with our own staff members, but it doesn't make it any easier 8 to 10 months, a year to work out the legals through an internal pilot on whether we're going to predict someone's about to have a baby and that will breach their employment terms and conditions. So it's very well looked at, and the accuracy of these algorithms is tested thoroughly for us before we ever put anything into the customer's hands.
One sentence, because I want this lady to have a question.
Just one brief follow-up. It's not only about the correctness of the algorithms. It's also not only about the data privacy. Your data is biased. If you don't pay attention to that, then your algorithm can be correct, but the outcome is not particularly interesting then.
It's a fair challenge. Okay, lady here, and then we have, I think I'll take the final question over here, I'm afraid. Time is pressing.
Just one comment. That you take images and you aggregate and summarize them in a feature vector doesn't mean that you clean the information about the images. Like, I can get your vector and get back to your images if I really want to.
Yeah, so we know. So there's no way to go from our feature vector, which is not a common feature, the time series detector. You can't recreate the image or the graphic imagery from it. It's literally a long list of numbers that doesn't correlate to objects. So we don't care about the objects or the faces or the colors in the image. We care about the way they ping into our personality metrics or into our characteristics metrics. So there's no way to recreate it, and that's one of the... So if it, even if you could recreate it, you'd still have to access the end user's device because we keep that on the device at all times. We never use a server or a cloud for any of our data. So everything happens, everything is happening on the device in real time.
Okay.
Nothing extracted.
And I want a quick question, not a comment.
Yeah, okay. So Keith, I'm a researcher at the University of Oxford, serving military officer. I wondered if you might reflect on the potential applications of some of these technologies in data-driven influence campaigns, such as those run by organizations like Analytica and a lot of companies. What does that mean for democracy and society?
What does that mean? Should I take that one?
Okay. Yeah. I got a flight to catch. So if you can just focus the
So specifically, I'm really interested in that intersection of AI with the behavioural sciences, which everybody has talked about today. So, for example, there's a research paper last year that indicated that you can predict somebody's politics in parts based on their facial structure and build. They start to raise really important questions for how people are then targeted and influenced. And I wondered if you'd given any consideration to what that meant for the
company. A really good question, actually. So I missed it. But I think, actually, that's probably where Pixeneye wants to go. And this is what we started the company for, which is predictive. And I think there's what people are missing, that there's enough data today that we're generating ourselves without sharing it on the cloud to be able to predict these things. For example, if we're looking at crime rates, and we're having this discussion, obviously being from Israel, we've done these, had the discussion before. Obviously, this will be a separate company to Pixeneye that's dealing with commercial and marketing stuff. But if you have enough data of true positives, you can always infer another true positive. For example, we're talking with a police force from Singapore that we're discussing about getting, if you get 10,000 phones of criminals who've committed the same crime, and I can analyze their photo gallery from the day of the crime backwards, as in to create a 6 to 8 months pattern of analysis on their photo gallery, can I then create a model that predicts, okay, within this timeline, as these photos, as these patterns start appearing, can I predict the probability? And it's always a prediction of probability. It's never saying this guy's going to commit that same crime or not. There's a certain probability of it. Can I say there's an 85% chance that this human being is going to commit this crime within the next 3 months? And that technology is being checked constantly. And that's where the idea of analyzing on device and analyzing things can come in handy. We're talking with about insurance. It's the same thing. If you give me, especially mental health diseases. If you can give me 10,000 people that have had the same mental health disease appear at around the same time, and I can have their photo gallery from the day of the analysis backwards, can I give a probability metrics to somebody incurring that same mental health disease? And that's what we're working on now. That's what we're going to see coming in prediction analytics and predictive behavior in the coming years, right? So that's what we're going to see. Final point.
That is what risk profiling is, right? We're going to look back over 300 years and see what characteristics made up someone who ended up having a heart attack. And if we see those same characteristics in someone applying for life insurance, we're going to make a broad assumption they're going to... So I don't think it's about the advent of just new technology. I think this exists. I think it's the speed that we're able to do it at and the volume, which is more scary. And it's funny you mentioned Singapore because... they're quite open, some of the startups that work there, about what they're doing with the government. And via Singtel, using the mobile networks there is a systematic campaign to track government and voting and political views across the whole country. So, I think it's quite well established in the commercial space.
Roshan, final point from you on all that?
You good?
Staying right on. Okay, all right. Well, everyone, we've gone into extra time. Every football analogy going here. We've gone into extra time, but I think it's because the quality of the sport was so good. So I challenged the UEFA Champions League panel to perform, and they've been a Leo Messi this afternoon. So thank you to Anthony, Ofri, Roshan. Nick's had to go. Ofri, you have to dash back to Barcelona. So thank you to the panel. And please do get in touch with Donna and the team here, or indeed our team out in Tel Aviv, if you are interested in delving deeper into the Israeli market. For those British institutions that haven't engaged with Israelis, I'll give you the same advice that the Israeli ambassador Mark Regev gave to me 18 months ago as I was departing for Tel Aviv, which is, don't interrupt an Israeli when he's interrupting you. Thanks.
I want to say also special thanks to Michal, who have put this session together. Yeah. Thank you.
So, thank you, Tony. We're moving straight ahead to the next game. So we are running a bit late. We have Ariel Shoham, who is entrepreneurial in residence for Amdocs, one of the largest companies in Israel, and also founder of Smart Sparrow, who is a company that deals with AI and learning systems. Ariel?
Okay, thank you. So my name is Ariel. First of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and be exposed to all these important and interesting discussions. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm one of the founders of a company which is called Smart Sparrow. Smart Sparrow is an adaptive e-learning platform that's spun out of UNSW, University of New South Wales, in Sydney, Australia. So we started our journey researching the intersection between artificial intelligence, or more commonly known as intelligent tutoring systems, that started back in the 50s with mainframe computers that proved the point of people having the ability to learn or study together. And so the intersection between AI and learning or teaching. Which brings me to this, the topic that I was given. So as you can imagine, we are a group of engineers, but our domain is the education space. So when I read this topic, copied from the email that I received, which I decided to leave it as is just to give you an example of how different people perceive the same thing differently. Because since I'm in the area of education, I read the first sentence, which might be very, very obvious for you, shifting away from supervised learning in the context of AI. For me, it means a totally different thing. Because when we talk about supervised learning, it's like people in the classroom supervised by the teacher, moving away from this model and then going through a flipped classroom, flipped teaching, unsupervised learning of people like minding their own stuff, and then there's someone walking around the classroom and just giving them guidance. So developing methods that use unlabeled data, learning from interacting with the environment, all these things are compiled differently from my perspective than from yours. Okay, So I tried to give this topic my own interpretation that fuses the two worlds or combines them together. So shifting away from supervised learning, the way I see it is like supervised learning means top-down approach of the content subject matter experts defining the rules, or the person, you know, coding the algorithm, setting the guidelines for what's perceived correct or what's incorrect, or how the algorithm actually decides on how to do things, which is the way that we do things currently, to the unsupervised learning modality, which is more of a bottom-up kind of an approach of, here's a new data set, based on what you know, try to understand what's going on there. Or if we use a medical analogy, here are the symptoms, we don't know exactly to perform the root cause analysis, but what's the diagnosis of all this? So these are the topics that I would like to cover today in my talk. First, it's the intelligent tutoring systems and the intersection between AI and education. Empowering teachers. So we started our journey by investigating how come technology hasn't picked up in the education space. And we realized that one of the main reasons is probably because there was a generation of engineers that came up with solutions. We call them teacher in a box. So they came to the teachers and say, okay, we know more than you do about this subject. Here's a piece of software that does the work for you or instead of you. So we realized that the whole thing, the secret sauce for creating this new dynamic that we're after, relies in re-architecturing or architecturing new platforms that create a separation between the pedagogy and the engineering and gives the teachers the complete ownership of the pedagogy and the complete control over the content, basically. Another thing which is very important is the student expectations, of course. It's a very disturbing situation that people, you know, my kids that were born into the age of internet and iPads and so on, when they will go to the university, they'll have to go through the same system of someone lecturing and going through the lecture mode. And the process, I want to take you through the production, the production process of creating what we call a smart course. And in the context of this discussion, it's interesting because our platform actually lends itself very well to the various topics that we discussed here today. And actually introduces a framework that allows people to train machines how to do things for them. So we started SmartSparrow at about 2011. It was a spin out of UNSW. We raised up to date about $30 million. We won $15 million in grants. Australia is a perfect place for getting funded, just so you know. First we thought, okay, we'll create the best tool ever that augments teachers, and once they see it, they will flock and they will adopt it and they will start using the platform. It didn't happen because academics are very, let's say, challenging in that sense. They see the product, they see the vision, they say this is amazing, but we need an end-to-end solution. So why don't you do everything for us? So we started as a product company and then we pivoted, and what we do is giving them the tools and the specialists needed to create active and adaptive learning, which means we sit with vice chancellors and we show them the future of learning, and then we offer them a pathway that will take them from where they are now to where they want to be through lots of services and lots of technology. So this slide actually is the ideal model of, and it starts with interacting with the environment, which is one of the things that I highlighted in the piece that I received. So this is the best way to learn. It's active learning. So learning by doing, interacting with something, with a mission, with a model, with a question, whatever. And then being guided by someone who understands this journey and can give an adaptive feedback. So if you do something right, then you get a credit for it. If you don't do something wrong, then you have the adaptive feedback that says this is something wrong, here's why, and then remediating the misconception on the spot, basically. And then the second part is the adaptive lesson pathway. So once recognizing what the student is doing right or wrong allows the teacher that guides the session to actually, you know, carve the personalized learning path for the specific student. The problem is that this doesn't scale. If you have a one-on-one kind of a lesson, you put two, and then you add one student, it becomes like two or three students, it becomes a lecture mode. So the tutor is actually lecturing to the three students. So what we wanted to do is do the augmentation of teaching at scale. And this has many, many challenges. We wanted to leverage the power of technology and the internet in order to create something that can be deployed at scale. So taking the smarts of the teacher and allowing the teacher to augment his or her lesson and deploy it to a large cohort of students. The challenges are, first of all, we needed to deal with a contextual personalized conversation. So every student learns differently with interacting with different stuff and has different misconceptions. So how to automate scoring, how to infer what's good and what's right and what's wrong. The personalized accreditation is also an important topic that relates to the scoring. So collecting evidence for mastery of concepts, aggregation of performance descriptors, making early stage predictions, and in general, how to apply AI, quote unquote, because there's no AI in education. After watching Satya Nadella trying to ask a simple question and seeing the response that he got, I think we can all agree that it would be impossible to just like have a conversation with someone and says this guy knows about, physics or something. It's very challenging. So before we dive, we use this like phrase, rich, interactive, and adaptive. So let's understand what's in the foundations. What are the fundamentals of what we do? We say it's impossible to infer from like a sentence, a complex sentence, what the person knows or does not know. But what we do know how to do is to model the learning outcomes and model the performance descriptors and actually go down to the atomic level of what students' action really means. So what's an adaptive lesson? An adaptive lesson is actually an online lesson. So we are a software as a service platform that changes based on the on how the student interacts with the lesson. So as you can imagine, it's just a sequence of slides, and these slides tell a story. So I'm telling you something. I'm showing you an image. I'm showing you a video clip. I'm showing you a simulation, and this like it emulates what we call the conversational framework. It's a famous framework by Diane Lorillard that says the conversational framework is here. I'm giving you an information. And then in order to understand whether or not we're on the same page, I'm asking a threshold concept. And then based on the response, I reflect and adapt. This is how the conversation is actually generated. So an adaptive lesson is made out of screens that contain information. Here you can see screens that include information such as text, images, videos. And then what's special about our platform is we have like a huge library of what we call input widgets. Input widgets are specially designed widgets that allow us to ask questions, but not in a simple like MCQ way, but asking questions based on the interaction with the simulation. For instance, think about a flight simulator that the student interacts with, and then based on the interaction with the simulation, we can actually understand what the students know, what the students don't know, and act accordingly. So another thing that we do, which speaks to the point of learning by doing, is the screens that also include rich simulations. So what makes the lesson adaptive? The lesson is adaptive in two ways. One is once we understand the intent, or once we capture the interaction of the student with the lesson, we actually fire an adaptive feedback that relates to the specific action or the specific choice or that the student makes. And then we can also send the student down a personalized pathway, meaning that if we're in a math course, for instance, once the student has presented mastery in certain concepts, we can say, okay, the rest of the lesson is irrelevant for this person. We can actually send the student to interact with another like lesson or another branch and so on and so forth. So this was also from the topic that I received. So learning from interacting with the environment, which is something very unique for Smart Sparrow, what we do is we design simulations. So our interaction with teachers start with a question of, okay, it would be cool if, please complete the sentence. And then the conversation is very shallow. I need to create something on the LMS and so forth, so on and so forth. And then once they're being like unbound from their like, from technical considerations, then they say, okay, in a perfect world, what I would like to do is, and then it becomes interesting. So we have lots of these simulations which are tied into the platform, and actually behind the scenes we have APIs that know what's happening on the simulation and can actually give the educator the information on what the students know and what the students don't know. These are examples for scientifically accurate simulations that we use inside or within, embedded in lessons. So think about teaching students online on the sales or what happens during a physical activity, which goes from from the brains all the way to the cells, to the muscles, and so on and so forth. So once you break the process into the different elements involved, and you go to people who specialize in animations, you can generate beautiful sequences of learning experiences that take the students through a learning by doing kind of an experience that actually solidifies what we want to teach them and also informs us on what they know and how well they know it and so on. So how to create an adaptive lesson? These are the four elements of the platforms that we have. So first we have the author, which allows you to create the lesson. Once you create the lesson, which is again, it's a sequence of slides tied in together, wired together, 5 minutes. Okay. So you create the lesson, then you deploy to the students. The students interact with the lesson, and then they generate analytics, lesson analytics. And this is how we know and understand what they know and what they don't. And then there's an embedded feature that allows people to share their lessons with other teachers so they can collaborate on authoring or share it with students and so on. So this is how the authoring looks like. So this is like where you put the text and the images and everything. This is on the left-hand side you have the list of questions. And what's special about SmartSpare is this bit over here, which is the adaptivity panel that allows the teacher to define the rules that for correctness, for incorrect correctness, for mistakes and so on and so forth. What we call this is trap state technology. Trap state technology being the combination of several rules happening within the interaction with the lesson that informs the teacher on what's going with the specific student. And every question is mapped to the analytics panel. So in this analytics panel, you can see the interaction of students interacting with the same question. So these are the attempts. And then based on the feedback that they're getting, the idea is that the adaptive feedback that every one of those students receives guides them through to the correct response. So this is what we call the feedback loop, which allows people to actually fine-tune the lesson and makes the lesson smarter. What we found is that educators usually say, you know, I've been teaching this for like 20 years. I know exactly what the misconceptions are. Then we say, okay, let's put it on paper. Let's provide us with the architecture of how the flow goes. And then they come up with their like blueprint of the lesson. And once it's being deployed, surprise, surprise, they discover lots of things that they've never realized that were actually there. And this is actually the first, this is where it's going back to this, the topic of the talk of first we define the trap states and we define which preconditions are required, in order to achieve mastery and so on and so forth. But through this, what we call the fine tuning or the feedback loop, they're getting familiar with all sorts of new misconceptions that are received from students interacting with the lesson. And this is the bottom up kind of thing. So just an example, if I ask a student what's, 2 plus 5, so it can be 7 is the correct one, and then let's say someone says 13. There might be a reason for this 13. If it's not like modeled in this model, it will just be marked as default wrong. But what educators do is once they have access to this analytics, they say, okay, there's a new misconception that needs to be addressed for the next cohort of people, and this is what makes the lesson intelligent. So why is this important? Because once it's deployed to big numbers, you have we have the ability to predict, basically, based on the model interactions. So again, this is like a list of questions, all the questions in a lesson. Every question has this solution trace graph. What we see when lessons are deployed in large numbers is the ability to actually make forecasts. After like 2-3 lessons, we know exactly how the student is going to end up because it starts following a certain pattern. This is also taken from the lesson analytics panel. So you can see the average grade, the lesson completion. So 27% of the students completed the lesson. And here you see that after like 2,200 students that interacted with the lesson, there is 100% adaptive feedback in use. What does it mean? That all the adaptive feedback that the teachers have programmed were actually used. There is no like default wrongs, and there is nothing that surprises them because everything is built into the lesson. So the 2 plus 5 is 13. There's now a trap state in the lesson that actually fires a personalized feedback and a personalized pathway for this. And what we've discovered is that after like two or three iterations, educators are happy to share their lessons once they've been like, once they've gone through like two or three iterations and thousands of students, then they realize I've spent a lot of time creating this thing, but now it actually becomes an augmentation of my own self. The way I teach my own student can be adapted and can be deployed by any other teacher that teaches the same subject. So then they're happy to share. And the reason I'm showing this is that what emerged from this this whole dynamic is what we call the teaching networks. So the teaching networks is communities of people that actually invested in creating lessons. And once those lessons were tested and proven with cohorts of students, then they're confident sharing those lessons. So the next teachers that join the journey have ready-made lessons that they can either use as is or can just adapt and make changes as they wish. So how about I'll just show you a couple of a video that shows you the end result.
Of education is here. No lectures, no laboratories, no limits. Learning by doing in a virtual universe where you explore your interests and the frontiers of human knowledge. Natural science, engineering, math, social science, humanities, everything that matters in the real world matters in PlanetWorks. It's education through exploration of the biggest unknown of all, our future. Our journey begins on Mars. Skills and knowledge needed to make a world work.
What if you tried this?
Yeah, let's try it. Success on Mars unlocks PlanetWorks Earth, a digital platform for engaging Earth's complex challenges, ultimately setting the stage for PlanetWorks Studio, an immersive blended year where you will unlock your entrepreneurial spirit and design real-world planetary-scale solutions.
Okay, I'll stop here.
PlanetWorks is full of learning experiences that are guided by an intelligent...
And... just a couple of more questions, more slides. So what you've just saw is all based on adaptive tutorials. So we always tell our customers, imagine what would happen if education has invested the money in generating learning experiences like the funds which are being allocated to creating like movies or games. And this is exactly what we are trying to promote. So this course that you've just seen starts with a compelling big questions of are we alone, which is broken to all the elements that needs to be mastered in order to be able to respond to this question. So it's got like a the streams, so general ed, physics, chemistry, and biology. And all these streams, in all these streams, there are missions, and those missions are all comprised of adaptive lessons, like the lessons that I showed you, or how to create this lesson, which form projects. So once you achieve mastery in each of those components, and you complete the project, you go through this journey, which eventually ends up with an accreditation. And this, just one last slide. This is Professor Michael Crow from ASU, which is the largest online university in the U.S. And in ASU, they have an annual summit called the GSV Summit, where all the who's and who's in higher education are being invited. And they're presenting their strategy and the latest in the edtech world. So this is Michael Crow presenting the future of higher education, where which the latest or the most advanced layer in their strategy is to introduce game-like experiences to their students, which allow students to just like play a game together, which is mapped to the learning curriculum, basically, to the curriculum, mapped to the learning outcome. So the result is that students are playing a game together, and after playing this game, they can take a test and actually succeed in the test without even going through like the formal education, the classroom model, and so on. We're out of time, right? Okay. Thank you so much.
We have a minute for questions. We're out of minute.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you to do a test at the end if you're tracking learning progress as you go along. Surely you've got the information about whether the system is effective or not.
So we don't need to do a test. It's just like the way we explain it to the customers, basically. That it's all mapped to the curriculum. So through this learning through exploration, basically, gives them the ability to passively learn and get the accreditation for the curriculum or get a certificate at the end, basically. So there's no test.
Okay, sorry, I thought you just said they had a test at the end and that.
No, so the way he explains it is that this learning experience is mapped to the curriculum in a way that every task, every project is like ticks the boxes of what needs to be mastered in order to get the accreditation.
Okay, that's what I was slightly worried about, because one of the traditional problems with that approach to learning is that it's too context bound, and so people can't take the learning and then apply it somewhere else. So that's why I was asking how you make sure that learning isn't just in that context.
Yes, so one is, I haven't showed it to you, but there's an ability to adapt the lesson. So take this ready-made lesson and then adapt it and make changes, contextualize, so change languages, change scenes, change the wiring of the trap states. So, you know, for me, one thing that works for me, you may say, okay, I would like to adapt this lesson, and then change the trap states and say, you know, if the student does this and watched this video and responded correctly to this simulation and completed this task, then it's considered from my end as a teacher completion of the task and a successful like ending.
I should talk.
Thank you. Yes.
In terms of time, you are the same material.
It is faster, slower, same time.
So it's much faster because obviously it's an online synchronous or unsynchronous experience. It depends on how you want to model it. But it replaces a semester of you know, talks and going back and forth with lectures and homework. So it replaces the traditional way of teaching with something which is much more engaging. And we've run like several A/B tests of taking the lesson before and then taking the game or the lab or the adaptive tutorials and doing the reverse order. It doesn't really matter. Students are happy either way. The brain forces it to find learning objectives, so the bar is learning basically. And the teachers are obviously very happy because they are very well informed and are in full control of the process because they have the analytics and they know exactly
which students to focus their attention on, and which students, who needs what kind of assistance, what are misconceptions, so they can actually personalize the teaching through this technology, providing insights that relates to individuals.
One last question there.
Birgit Anderson, Big Innovation Center. My question is, what is the uptake of it, and who are the uptakers? Is it universities, is it secondary school, primary school, and who's paying for it, and what do you believe that the cost is of running this at scale?
So thank you very much. We're going to take a break of 10 minutes, I guess.